Okay, Delta Stewardship Council's called to order, starting with Mr. Nordhoff. Let's establish a roll for quorum purposes. Nordhoff here. Eisenberg here.
Fiorini here.
And where's Gloria Gray? Would you identify yourself for the quorum, please?
Gloria Gray present.
Okay, we have a quorum present. Mr. Grindstaff, today is focused on emergency flood levy related issues, but why don't you put it into context for people who may not have been here yesterday and those watching on the simulcast?
I will do that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I discussed yesterday, the first draft Delta plan was released. It's been 3 weeks ago now. It included the key elements were findings upon which many of the decisions will be made. Those findings were referred to the Independent Science Board, who is going to make comments. And based on their comments, we've asked our science program staff to actually help redraft the findings. Our expectation is that we won't get the final comments from the Independent Science Board until the next meeting. That's either the 24th or 25th of this month. So the next draft Delta plan will not include revised findings, but rather have a placeholder indicating that they're being reviewed by the scientists. It will, however, include everything else that was kind of missing. And there were a couple of things that were missing in the last draft that have been released. We did release a chapter on adaptive management and the findings on water quality so that those things could be reviewed. Those have been posted to the web.
Yeah, they were posted yesterday, I think, or the day before.
Hopefully the day before. So those things have happened. In the next draft, which will be released a week from today, probably late a week from today, if history is any guide, we will actually include the proposed policies that actually become the enforceable part of the Delta plan and the proposed recommendations. So the way the legislation's written, the plan is an enforceable document, and the way it, I'll give an example of how you would enforce it. You would have a policy that says it's the policy of the council that you shouldn't build a hotel in the middle of the Suisun Marsh. That's kind of a gross
exaggeration. As opposed to the two large duck clubs that are there now, which have some of the same characteristics.
This is a new hotel.
Okay.
So you shouldn't build a hotel in the middle of the Suisun Marsh. And when and if a covered action came up for review in front of the council, if somebody was indeed building a hotel in the Suisun Marsh in a bad place, then the council would say that's inconsistent with the Delta plan. So that's how that regulatory policy would take effect, I think. So that's, as we develop a plan, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about having maps, and risk reduction is a really important part of that plan. And so our goal is today to actually hear from these experts and stakeholders about what the plan should include moving forward, so that we can be informed by that as we draft the plan over the next few days, redraft it, and actually release something next Friday. To remind everyone, there will be numerous opportunities to continue to comment on this because the next draft comes out, as I said, a week from today. After that, in April, there will be another draft. In May, there will be another draft, and the council will make the decision to circulate. We hope the council will make the decision to circulate the plan along with the EIR at the end of May. So, and even after that, then there will be a couple more opportunities for comments and changes, although hopefully we will get the major changes, the major policies in place in the draft that actually the council approves for circulation in May.
Okay, I should probably just say to the panelists, regretfully, all of us have to turn our cell phones off, not mute, but off, because the sound system picks up the interference that comes in, and our powerful and angry-looking sound technicians usually come around and take all the instruments from us. Mr. Baldwin. Okay, a man wearing an OES hat, I suppose, has that duty. Okay.
Say yes.
Yeah, I just said yes. Okay. Mr. Hardy, if you would kick off the panel, please, and introduce the guest.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Eisenberg. Let me first thank all the panelists for coming this morning, and at least one of the members of the panel has been up most of the night dealing with some preparedness issues, I guess, Ron. Isn't that right? So let me also remind you that I think we've got enough microphones up there. If you need to speak, there's a red button on the microphone, and you need to press that till that's lighted up, and also to speak into it. The sound folks will be happy about that. So first, I'd like to ask the panelists to each do a brief self-introduction, and then I'll just tee this up quickly, and we'll get right into the presentations. Dr. Seed, do you want to start off? And we'll need you
this
to speak.
This is self-introductions.
Self-introductions. I'm not.
Hi, I'm Raymond Seed, and I'm a professor at the University of California at Berkeley.
Ron Baldwin, I'm the Director of Emergency Operations for San Joaquin County. I've been in that position 28 and a half years, and through seven floods significant enough to warrant a presidential declaration of major emergency.
Mike Machado, got to get you on there.
Push the little button here.
Mike Machado, Executive Director, Delta Protection Commission.
Gilbert Cosio, MBK Engineers. We represent reclamations in the Delta 27, mostly in the North and Central Delta.
Dave Meraz with Department of Water Resources, Principal Engineer for the Delta Levees Program.
I'm John Kane with American Rivers. I'm the Conservation Director for Central Valley Flood Management, and in that capacity I've been involved in the Central Valley Flood Management Planning Process and the Bay Delta Conservation Planning Process.
Richard Roos Collins, Legal Director, Natural Heritage Institute. Good morning.
Also, we have some handouts we received this morning. They'll be posted on the website. These are handouts from, I believe, the panelists. There were two handouts in the packet you distributed yesterday that related to flood control. One is called The Major Problems with Flood Response, but that's not attributed to anyone.
Ron Baldwin.
Okay, Mr. Baldwin. Okay. And then there was the Department of Water Resources draft paper.
Right. Okay. So just a reminder, for each of the panels, we're operating in the same way. We're going to ask each of you to present some initial remarks. All of you have provided some written comments in response to the focus questions that were provided for panel C, and that's very helpful to because we're going to keep coming back to the focus questions. The structure for today's panel is going to be just slightly different. I'm going to ask the first six of you to give your presentations and ask Richard to hold off just for a little while because he's going to provide somewhat of an integrative set of comments after we've talked a bit in more focused fashion about preparedness and response issues. And so whenever the chair and the council are ready, we'll give Richard the high sign. But for now, don't attribute his muteness to shyness, because I've never known him to be shy before. So I think what we'll do is just start down the row. And Dr. Seed, if you want to start off, remember to turn your microphone on.
Okay, am I on?
You're on.
You are.
Okay, and my understanding is I got 5 minutes and 11 seconds.
And I have a timer here, just to remind all the panelists, we are using a timer to encourage you to stick to your time commitment, and so we have most of the time for dialogue. So,
okay.
I'll give you 11 seconds.
Thank you. I reorganized a bit. You guys asked us four really good questions, each of which had four subtopics within them, and there were some priorities asked for within each of those. That was about 64 different items. I just did five. I did it in more integrated fashion. But I believe that I answered all your pieces. If you have my sheets, the first thing you asked, and you asked repeatedly, was what are the big priorities out there in terms of risk? And the answer is there are three principal priorities. One is the risk to the water systems and water delivery. One is the risk to ecosystems and environmental values. And one is the risk to everything else in the Delta, which runs from lives, lands, infrastructure, agriculture, and those types of things. The risks are poorly understood because there's two flavors for each. The biggest risk to the environment is water delivery. The biggest risk to water delivery is the environment. And so they are each other's first risk, but they're also both threatened by levee fragility, both static and seismic, as is everything else in the Delta. As a levee guy, I'm going to go after levee risk as a key issue and point out there's two flavors of levee risk, and that's also generally poorly understood by the public. There's seismic and non-seismic. We don't understand seismic risk very well at a policy level because we haven't seen it. We have, however, seen over 160 levee failures in the last century plus a decade. And so we have good experience with the static ones. Seismic levee risk is infrequent, but it's catastrophic. Static levee risk, which is breaches from under seepage, through seepage, piping, overtopping, erosion, and similar, we get that fairly routinely, and it's an expensive nuisance. It's a battle that can be won at some price. And so in the static lists, the point I'd like to emphasize is it can be managed at some cost, but it will fall to you guys to make some pronouncements as to what the cost should be and to what extent it should be managed. The seismic risk is very different. The seismic risk will always lurk in the background. We haven't had a big earthquake for over a century that would have affected the Delta, but in the last century, from 1850 to 1906, we had probably five, possibly six earthquakes that would have been pretty devastating for the Delta. We get about 50 years of action and then a half century or a century of quiet as the faults reload, and we're now reloaded. So we're probably heading into an active period, and we've had snaps and crackles, but no big pops yet in the last 15 years, so we do appear to be fulfilling that cycle. So I would caution you guys that, for my money, one of the priorities that's been left largely off the table is seismic levee fragility and its consequences in terms of hanging over everything else. Then cutting in a different direction, I'd like to point out that you guys have the opportunity and a need for creative thinking. I don't think that these are issues we're going to solve in traditional ways. An awful lot of people who have vested interests in some portion of the Delta are fighting desperately to retain what they've got and perhaps sometimes grab a little bit more, and they're taking very conventional viewpoints. I hope you guys will exercise some free thinking and go beyond that. The Delta is, for instance, not monolithic. It's not necessary that we defend equally the entire Delta. We already own, as a state of California, some of the deeper western islands, and some of those could be reverted to other uses. They could be flooded, they could be used for carbon sequestration farming, which might become lucrative in the years ahead if we project ahead on global warming and the policies evolving around that. So there's room for some new thought there, and some of that would be beneficent to the environment, and it would reduce risk in other areas. Finally, priorities for actual protection. Within the Delta itself, leaving aside water and ecosystems as being co-equal first values, of the pieces that are left, the obvious first one is human life. We've got to be very careful to protect humans. We can do that either by getting people out of the Delta or at least keeping new people from moving into dangerous positions, but we can also do that by providing better protections for people who are in place, and especially so if they're coupled with better rescue capabilities. There has been an underinvestment in preparation for rescue and response, and I assume my colleagues sitting next to me will get a chance to address that at the back end. That's front and center. That's a not very expensive preparation, and it's hugely cost-effective when the moment arises. Then there comes infrastructure. There is myriad infrastructure in the Delta. I start with the McKellamy aqueducts, which are irreplaceable, can't be moved easily, and service a large number of people. Then there's three highways. It's not obvious that all three highways could be protected against seismic fragility or that they would need to be, but there needs to be some thought as to what happens if one of those highways becomes unserviceable. It might be response and repair. It might be that we'd have to alter our traffic routes. Same with railroads. There's multiple railroad lines across the Delta. If you ask the railroads, there's no way they could share a single piece of track. If you tell them they're all out of business unless they share a piece of track, they'll all be able to share a piece of track. PG&E has gas storage, which is vitally important. That can be serviced underwater. It should be configured to be such just in case it becomes underwater. And then we have buried pipelines of various types and overhead power lines and similar. All those things need serious thought. Okay, very end. Last two pieces. One of the questions you asked that was good is what could be done outside the Delta that would help the Delta? I like to spin that around and point out that inside the Delta you can help outside. We're going to put a lot of people into the San Joaquin River Basin, and we could have a flood bypass at the south side that would look like the Yolo bypass at the north side on the Sacramento River, but only if we move quickly, and that prevention of irresponsibly risky development should be a co-priority with that. Thanks.
Thank you.
If there aren't any questions from council members right now, we'll...
Yeah, let's go. I think we want to try to get the statements first and then circle back for 90 minutes or more on questions.
Okay. Ron?
Yeah, what I didn't want to do is just necessarily just repeat what I wrote up. Hopefully it takes you 2 minutes to read that and just make some general comments. You know, unfortunately, as you've learned with other issues here, unless you kind of dig a little deep and spend a little time, you really can't get past the superficialities and some of the fluff on some of these issues, and unfortunately, emergency response is the same way. I mean, the council, if you really want to understand some of the issues and barriers to making the system better, I think you need to spend a little bit of time, because, you know, just like everything else, reality isn't usually what the theory says reality is supposed to be. And I think there's some real fundamental things that could be done in emergency response in the Delta that would make big strides in effectiveness. But, you know, if you don't understand the system, often you don't see those things. The other thing I'd say is that, we've treated floods too long for about 40 years a little bit as an ad ho sort of thing. And I think two things have happened. Number one, floods don't happen very often, big ones. And two, we've kind of gotten mesmerized by the system set up years ago for the flood insurance program. You know, so we have this concentration on the levy, you know, and the certification of the levy and all that goes into that and the land use and the things that go into a flood insurance program. And we've kind of forgot that there's a real world out there and reality and the fact that it will flood sometimes and kind of deal with these issues and deal with some of the detailed planning, hopefully, that we can show you that can be done, that surprisingly just hasn't been done. And, you know, unlike what's often said, is some of this, it doesn't cost a lot of money. It just takes a certain amount of attention to recognize it, recognize the reality of floods and what can happen and doing some of the pre-planning that would make us much more effective. So hopefully you'll kind of look through the two pages, and hopefully I can get into some details on what's being said in a little more depth after you've seen gotten the introduction, had a chance to read the handouts.
Okay, thank you, Ron. Mr. Machado.
Yep. Thank you. I'd like to address some of the issues that you have presented.
Mike, could you get that mic a little closer to you, because it's hard to pick up the sound on the simulcast unless you do.
Take the issues that was asked of us. First of all, I respond to land use. Part of the problem, I think, it provides risk in the Delta is the fact that the secondary zone, which was probably envisioned at the beginning of the Delta Protection Act back in 92 to be a buffer between the urbanization along the rim of the Delta and the primary zone. There's been an extensive amount of intrusion into the secondary zone. So it's what I kind of termed that they're building up to the point where the sound wall that separates the secondary and the primary zone. And part of the considerations, I think, for managing the Delta, particularly with respect to properties and people safety, is being able to maintain that buffer zone, because that buffer zone does indeed contain some of the opportunities for floodways, particularly in the south portion of the Delta, that can act as a way to alleviate some of the head of floodwaters that come into the Delta. Secondly, when we talk about flood control, we can't just talk about flood control in the Delta. We need to talk about flood control in the Central Valley, of which a management plan for flood management in the Delta is a part of that. There is things that can occur in the upper watersheds, particularly along the San Joaquin River, that mimic what is done in the Sacramento, such as the Yolo Bypass and Sutter Bypass, in order to be able to provide some relief. That also opens itself up for being able to use areas to divert floodwaters for groundwater replenishment, to look at a way of augmenting the aquifers in the southern part of the Central Valley. That also can also be a part of a reoperation of the reservoirs to be able to accommodate that, though I do, there are significant problems with the agencies involved with the multipurpose reservoirs that we have because of the multipurposes served. In the Delta, I think we have to make sure there's a distinction made between those levees that are protected by PL 8599 standards and differentiate between those urban areas where they live up to urban standards. Along with the urban standards, I think consistent with protection of the people and property, is look at the imposition of 200-year standards on all urban areas, not just new development. And flood control is best functions at the local level. You can have it part of a statewide emergency management plan, but the functionality of responding to a flood control is best implemented
at a local level. And I think Mr. Baldwin's shop and operation in San Joaquin County exemplifies the ability to be able to do that in a very effective and an efficient way. One of the things that could be expanded at the local level, particularly in the Delta, is looking at a regional coordination of flood control with some sort of entity defined that would have operational control over all the various county flood controls, for example, within the Delta. There could be looking at a formation of a geohazard abatement district as a way of bringing in beneficiary pays for more funding. Some call this a jihad. I think there is some, it's worth exploring. There are some issues there related to how that would be involved, particularly in this particular environment. The other thing I caution is that we cannot single out in the Delta a portion for it to be protected and avoid others, unless the avoidance of others and the consequences of what happens is acceptable as part of the flood management problem. Because if we don't look at the Delta as a whole, then singling out particular pieces could threaten the survivability of the whole. Then the last thing on is funding. We've always had a lack of funding in the Delta to be able to provide for the maintenance of levees and to meet, have standby monies to be able to assist local governments in a response. And part of that is related to the funding sources on non-project islands is basically come from property owners, but those efforts provide benefits to others who use the Delta either for transportation corridors, for highway, for utility infrastructure, for transportation, for railroads, etc. So I think it's not just a simple look. And we can't forget, too, that you have a population within the Delta and that many times goes beyond just a few years. And so the integration of flood control and protection on that really is a broader prescription than just looking at any individual particular area.
Okay. Mr. Cosio.
Thank you. My comments also are going to be a little more general compared to my written response. Two of the points are covered in my written response, and one is just one that I want to bring up. Based on certain documents I've been reviewing the last couple of days, it concerns just the public perception of what we're doing out here. And so I'm really interested after the discussion of listening to your questions and answering them, because I really don't know what you don't know. And when you look at some of the publications that come out and some of the comments on the blogosphere, people that say they know really don't know either. So. I hate to sound like a broken record, but since Mike mentioned it, I don't feel so bad, but it's our opinion that the Delta should stay in its current configuration, and it's not just because we work and many of us live down there. There are other reasons, the biggest of which being is the legislature stated so in the Water Code that the unique values of the Delta are invaluable and irreplaceable, and the key to those values are the levee system that form the islands, protect the habitat, and also form the channels that that also have habitat and other critters. Without these levees, you wouldn't have any of that. I mean, I think the publications you see these days break it down to a few farmers that want to get subsidized money to maintain levees just to protect their property. And I don't know any farmer that thinks that way. I mean, obviously, they're there to make money. It's not just the value of their property. It's their livelihood. But they also are great stewards of the environment, whether they want to be or not. I mean, just the fact they're essentially all wetlands provide tremendous habitat. And sometimes it comes back to bite us. For instance, just recently, the city of Stockton is building a pumping plant on the San Joaquin River, building the pumping plant on the Empire Tract levee. Because they're putting the pumping plant on our levee, they had to build a new levee behind it. And getting a Corps of Engineers permit, they had to do some monitoring for giant garter snake. Well, lo and behold, they found three giant garter snakes. So we know they're out there. You just have to look. And unfortunately, or fortunately for the environment, that now that we do work out on an Empire Tract in King Island, we'll have to kind of do the same thing. But there's a lot of resources like that that just aren't real obvious to people that occur daily in the Delta. And I think the current publications break down the delta also just into water supply and a couple of fish. And I think if you actually come out here and look, you'll see as ships go by, boaters go by, water skiers, wakeboarders, that there's a lot more going out here on out here than just the typical water supply heading south and a few endangered species fish that habitat in the water. The other next point I want to make concerns funding. Yesterday I heard David Guy and Jonas Minton talk about funding available in Prop 1E, and they both mentioned that the delta should be maintained and that use of this money should go to help maintain these levees. Obviously, we don't have enough money to maintain the levees to resist seismic forces at this time, but we do have enough money to take a good whack at the reduction in risk due to flood. And for the last couple of years, we've been told that Prop 1E will provide somewhere around $500 million. Well, recently, DWR published their investment framework, which will be presented to you if it already hasn't, where they indicate that their top priority is urban levees. And this is something we were told right after Prop 1E passed, was that the $3 billion is going to go to reduce our liability in the form of working on urban levees. And they're right. The way the legislation is written, it's up to them to decide that sort of thing. But we feel that the voters, as they looked at the five different items that we'd be funded with, the $3 billion, saw that delta risk reduction on levees would be part of that. And so we're going to ask you and or the legislature to help us and get that money, because we do not think that it's allocated, formally allocated for levee work. And then the last thing I want to talk about are just some of the data that come out these days. You know, I sat on the steering committee for the DREAM study. I was interviewed for some of the initial PPIC reports. And I don't want to criticize or disrespect the authors of those documents, but a lot of the information that went into the documents is erroneous. And it's not their fault. I mean, there was a time frame crunch to get these documents out. And so in essence, they didn't gather all the data that should have been. And so when I look at documents that show subsidence where I know it hasn't occurred in 30 years, continuing on for the next 100 years, that causes me alarm that, hey, it's garbage in and garbage out. Why can't anybody look and see that sort of thing? There was a blog yesterday from one of the PPIC authors that talked about some of the issues with levees. And some of the data there is just not right. And so at some point, it would be nice to sit down and really talk about what the real data are and then how that erroneous data that got into these reports may have affected the results. Thank you.
Thank you. Dave?
Okay, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here and talk about my own views with respect to the Delta. These will not be the views of the Department of Water Resources. First of all, we all heard about the earthquake last night and the tsunami this morning, and the Emergency Operations Center for the Delta has been in operation since 2 o'clock. So that part of the emergency system is working. The reclamation districts have been notified of what's coming in. And at San Francisco, you can expect about a 1.5-foot increase in tide. I don't think that that's going to have any effect on the Delta at all, especially considering the fact that it came in at low tide. So other places will be more affected. There's also a minor emergency going on at Staten Island that I received a phone call on last weekend. And I'm saying this just to illustrate the fact that the emergency response for the Delta is taken seriously. There are people that regularly watch and have that as their job. So with that, I wanted to say that the levees do define the Delta. They without them, the Delta is a large lake. So they, in order to accomplish the co-equal goals for the Stewardship Council, the deltas have to, or the delta levees have to be one of your highest priorities. The system that's in place right now through the Delta Levees program has been working for 30 years to make sure that there's money for operation and maintenance, that there's money for improvements. Now, the reclamation districts have a relationship with the state that has been working very well. The state's got exceptional value from this operation or this partnership, and I believe the local interests have received a great value as well. That could change for the good or for the bad, depending upon how we move forward as a Delta Stewardship Council, as a Department of Water Resources, as reclamation districts. Funding is definitely an issue, and detailing out that funding has to be a consideration. When the voters say X number of dollars go into flood management and they don't say so much for the Central Valley, so much for the West Coast, so much for the Delta, then it leaves it up to the department to make some judgments about where those funds go. I think the department tries to do a good job of laying out what its goals and objectives are and to follow those goals and objectives with their funding strategy. Others might disagree. Permitting is an issue, and one of the things that we're dealing with right now is the ability to complete the mitigation that's necessary for conducting levee work. We can go ahead and identify the problems, develop the mitigation lands, but as far as making sure that those lands are operated and maintained, we have a difficulty in funding the endowments that are necessary to make that happen. So that might be some place where your influence could be a benefit to the folks in the Delta that are doing the work. And I think the vision of the legislature to keep the Delta as it is a good one. I don't think that they meant to have a static Delta, though. I think there are methods that have been used elsewhere in the world that we can take advantage of, and I'll use Holland as the example of polders, where they take and combine individual islands into a large area that limits the number of levee miles. And I think by applying a philosophy like polders, you might get to a point where you can actually start to put in seismically resistant levees. I agree with Dr. Seed that the static stability of the levees can be well handled with the existing system. The seismic stability is one of those things that we are not currently able to handle. So I think we need to be a little imaginative regarding how we deal with that problem. And I think those are the comments that I wanted to make this morning, and thank you again for the opportunity to talk.
Thank you very much. Mr. Kane.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak. First, I'd like to talk a little bit about American River's philosophy on how to address this issue, and then touch on three priorities: expanding bypasses, mitigating residual risk, and promoting infill development versus sprawl in terms of land use in the Delta. First of all, in terms of our philosophy, we believe that protecting public safety has to be the highest priority, because a catastrophe is going to come in the future, and if the public is not protected from it, that catastrophe and the conflict that will follow or precede it will just impoverish all the communities that depend on the Delta and the rivers, including the natural communities. And it's just not tenable to have a conflict between protecting the environment and protecting public safety. So we're very focused on what we can do about protecting public safety while also restoring rivers. Secondly, it's very clear to us that we can only solve these problems through an integrated approach. And fortunately, there's a lot of different objectives people are trying to do in the Delta: water supply, ecosystem restoration, and flood risk reduction. Unfortunately, these have been treated as three separate efforts, and I'm hoping that you can help bring these together and integrate them, because that's the way we'll have enough resources to really make a difference. So in terms of our top three priorities, number one is to expand the bypass system so we can safely convey more floodwater from the terminal reservoirs through the urbanized reaches in the lower river and into the tidal delta. Our mantra, my mantra, which I hope will be your mantra, is that we cannot solve the ecological problems in the delta without restoring floodplains, and we cannot restore the Central Valley flood problems without giving rivers more room to flood. Here is a perfect integration opportunity. There's great opportunities for expanding the Yolo Bypass. A study by Safeco shows that you could reduce flood stage in Sacramento in the 100-year event by 3 feet at I Street Bridge through expansion of the Yolo Bypass. My organization has proposed another new bypass, which we call the Ship Channel Bypass, which I can explain in more detail, which would essentially allow you to take water off the Sacramento River near Garcia Bend in the Pocket area.
Of
Sacramento, that's right, and send it downstream towards Prospect Island, creating a mini Yolo Bypass, but also really reducing flood stages not only in Sacramento, but for communities like Walnut Grove and Clarksburg and RD-999. We know there's and lastly and most exciting, this idea of a South Delta flood bypass. I'm pleased to report to you that last week American Rivers joined with several local entities, including the South Delta Water Agency, the River Islands Reclamation District, the San Joaquin County RCD, in submitting a proposal to the Flood Corridor Program to begin buying flood easements south of Paradise Cut to create a new flood bypass. The second priority is mitigating residual risk in existing and permitted development areas. My bumper sticker that I'm going to make for you guys is control risk, not floods. Your report on page 31 or line 31 of page 8-4 states that levees do not eliminate risk, levees reduce risk. That's actually false. Unfortunately, many levees actually increase risk significantly, because once you have a FEMA-certified levee, then you can put billions of dollars of infrastructure behind the levee. And risk is really the probability of failure times the consequences of failure. And so what we've just done is increase the consequences, increase the risk. A common misperception about this is, well, you know, I heard the former mayor of Oakley say, California is a dangerous place. There's fires, there's earthquakes, and why are you picking us in the floodplains? Well, when I did the addition on my house, I had to pay 20% more so that I have bolts that go from the foundation of my house all the way up to the second floor to withstand a very large earthquake on the Hayward Fault. My wife is a landscape architect. When she designs a deck in a fire zone in the Bay Area, the deck costs twice as much in materials because they have to design it with heavy materials so that it will not burn. Every time there's an event, the building codes are updated. The problem in the Delta and with levees is, if you're behind a certified levee, the building codes are exactly the same and everyone assumes there's not risk. In fact, FEMA calls it a moderate to low risk area behind a FEMA certified levee. I'll try to move quickly to finish up here. The Delta Stewardship Council needs to begin to internalize these risks on floodplains and make sure that people who move into floodplains understand them. Emergency response is critical and necessary, but not sufficient. Ron Baldwin is a hero, but he can't be there always. There's going to be really big events, and it may overwhelm emergency response, and we can't put all our eggs in that basket. Lastly, I wanted to talk a little bit about infill versus sprawl. I know you're going to be confronted with this idea of how can you regulate development and take property rights away and take the economic future away from the Delta. And I would just argue that promoting infill versus sprawl on floodplains will really help protect the Delta as a place and make the Delta a richer place to live, work, and play. And I need to point out that there's, maybe you saw the Brookings Institute report on the suburbanization of poverty. think it's really worthwhile reading to take a look at, to think about what is sprawl development going to look like in 50 years in the Delta? What kind of economic climate is there going to be? Are those people really going to have the money to deal with improving levees as sea level rises, not 55 inches? I heard today it's now, we're counting 69 inches. And it seems to me to make sense that if we concentrate development in urban areas, existing urban areas, those areas may have a chance. They may have the resources to keep up with sea level rise and expand levees. But if we just continue to allow sprawl, it just diffuses the, it just increases the number of parties that will be arguing for a limited pool of resources to repair levees. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, you, Mr. Collins, is, Bruce Collins is going to sit there for a while we ask questions, right?
Exactly.
Okay. Members, who wants to start? Pat?
Gil, I wanted to ask you about in your written comments where there's a question you responded to, what are the priorities for addressing sea level rise? If you could just speak to that. Your answer indicates that once you have a foundation that you believe that there can be incremental improvements in the levees to meet sea level rise risk. So that means that the levees can get a little bit higher in the years and you can keep pace with that risk? Is that
what Yes, what we did, we studied what a levee looks like after we rehabilitate it to PL 99 standards, and then once that's done, what will it take to keep up with sea level rise? So even sea level rise of 4 to 5 or 6 feet, it happens very slowly. So if you plan for it, you need to do two things. You need to make sure your ballast or your landside berms that support the levee, give it stability, are improved as well as raising the levee. So it's not just raising the top, but you've got to plan for it. And that's why we would emphasize, you know, a maintenance program that considers that. And if we... The study we did looked at, I think, 4 feet of rise in 100 years, and it's well within the current maintenance budgets of levee districts what the Delta Levee Subventions Program to keep up with sea level rise. The key, though, is planning for it, and you can't sit around and wait. A lot of times reclamation districts may decide, well, we're not going to do work this year. Well, the more years you don't do work, the more you have to catch up later.
That's Mr. Seed wanted to weigh in on that.
Yeah, and in the same way that there's some erroneous data floating around, there's also some misperceptions which have taken on force of legend. Sea level rise is not a good thing. It will make everything out there a little bit harder, but it'll only make it a little bit harder. We've lost 20 feet of subsidence in some portions of the deep central western delta over the past 160 years, and 4 or 6 more feet is just another increment of that. We have a 160-year history of dealing with progressive need to raise levees and can continue to do so, again, at a price. And so if the state of California decides that that's the delta we want to be protecting, it's certainly technically within our means. The other half of that is I would urge the council to consider the value of doing that to be much broader than the agricultural value of the land behind the levees, which has been the other side of the equation. As most of the speakers have pointed out, we've got tremendous other issues. We can operate agriculture in an eco-friendly way. We can reintroduce forests. There's all kinds of things we can do on those islands which will make them far more valuable, and we're protecting the water, which is deliverable as a resource and also as an ecosystem. So sea level rise is not the boogeyman that it's played up to be.
So, Gil, on your response, you said that... PL 99 standard would be sufficient as a foundation for increasing levee height and to some degree width in order to deal with sea level rise?
Right. That's our current goal for most levee districts is to attain the PL 99 standard. Or sometimes we look at what the state put out in 1982 called the Bulletin 192 standard, which is actually more the design we approach it. The results are close to the same. But by doing that, we have a very good agricultural flood control levy, not a seismic levy, but flood control.
Right, and I wanted to ask you about that because you distinguished in your remarks between sort of, I think what Dr. Seed referred to as static risk and seismic risk. How do you, as an engineer working on levees in reclamation districts, approach the seismic risk?
Well, we've actually thought about that, and instead of arguing on the probability of it happening or the magnitude, we use some of our money we got from Dave's program, the state levy program, to look at an actual levee on Webb Tract, which is one of the higher risk areas in the Western Delta. We took the actual data, and our geotech engineer, our assumption was, let's just liquefy the foundation. We don't care what the magnitude of the earthquake or the probability, let's just do it and see what happens. And in doing that, we came up with a design that we think will provide enough levee after an earthquake that we can come back and fix it easily rather than it pancaking out to nothing and then flooding the whole island. It involves a much wider crown, flatter slopes, and a seepage barrier down the center line to prevent seepage once it cracks. So we're planning for it. We just haven't got the funds to actually implement it.
To jump on that and point out that's a good example of exactly the kind of creative thinking that you guys have the opportunity to exercise here. It's not necessary to build bulletproof or earthquake-proof levees. It's probably necessary to build repairable levees, and what we have right now are probably not going to be repairable after a significant earthquake, but at a price we could remedy that, and the price of making repairable levees is far smaller than making earthquake-proof levees. So what Gil's talking about is a darn good middle position.
Yes, Ron?
I'm not an engineer, but I'll weigh in. One thing that I've noticed in 28 years is that whether it's the earthquake scenario or a flood, and going back to the issue of whether we make big polders or small polders or whatever, is these delta floods tend to be a bit self-limiting. It goes back to the old flood fight rule. You hope the neighbor goes first, right? Mm-hmm. Because that saves everyone else. When Jones Tract broke, I mean, we literally had portions of the channel that was mud, you know, I mean, it swept the water in. So, you know, in the real world, levees fail, but they don't tend to all fail simultaneously right at this moment. When that first one goes, you know, bad as it is, there's going to be this surge of water coming in. It's going to lower everything down. It's going to lower the flood crest. It's going to lower that. And it's going to save the islands around there for 2-3 days. Jones Tract took 3 days to fill. You know, one advantage having the smaller polders is when that first one goes, you don't flood a whole bunch of area, and at the same time, now you buy time to do some flood fight on the others, and maybe you get to the crest. So, I mean, the issue of that the delta is a system, I'm not saying you can't change it, but you want to be real careful tinkering with it, and it has some advantages the way it's built there. It also reduces wave wash because we got smaller fetches, et cetera. But, I don't envision this earthquake where they just suddenly all fail. I mean, any engineer would say, yeah, they'll crack, they'll slough, there's going to be a lot of things happening, but odds are there might be one that goes first, and that lowers the water level, and now you've got some time to deal with the rest. And I think that's a reality, too, that needs to be calculated. So I'd only throw that into the discussion, at least of what I've seen, and going back to that old flood fight rule.
Dave wanted to make a comment, and then back to Ray.
I didn't realize I raised my hand. That was a good observation. Thank you. I have, in my engineering experience, had the opportunity to go and take a look at dams that have been subjected to earthquakes. These structures are large, some of them embankments, some of them concrete, and they respond to earthquakes by cracking, by moving. The levees in the delta are very similar to dams in that they hold back water all of the time, but they're not built to the same standard that a dam would be built. So you end up with a lot of loose material both in the foundation and in the levee itself. And even if the water comes off of the levee because one of the islands fails, you still have water stored inside the embankment that weakens the structure upon shaking. And I think the look of the delta after a seismic event would be lots and lots and lots, miles of cracking a number of failed islands, so I think it's going to be a very significantly different event than what we've seen from the hydrologic flooding that we've had in the past.
This comes back to my earlier comments at the beginning of my presentation. I have walked many miles of seismically failed levees. Liquefaction is one of the things near and dear to my heart. And I walked miles of liquefied levees in the Kobe earthquake in 1995 in Japan. I walked many tens of miles of liquefied levees in the Taiwan earthquake of 1999. And again, multiple miles of liquefied levees in the Bhuj earthquake in India. And the problem with liquefied levees is they don't actually fail one at a time and the first one saves everybody else. What happens is they fail all at once. It is counterintuitive, but they all go down together. A typical delta levee, if it suffers liquefaction, will slump and lose about two-thirds of its height, which in most of the delta will put them well below river level. The water may be drawn down for a day or two and eventually fill back up, but there will be many miles of levees which will be underwater, and we won't be patching holes. Our experience in the delta is we've had 160 in round number of failures over the last 110 years, and each time we get a big hole, and it costs us right now about $30 million to about $110 million to patch the hole and pump the island out, and the pumping cost is the bigger variable. Big island costs a lot to pump. If we have an earthquake, we won't be patching holes. We'll have sections of multiple miles continuous where the levees have essentially largely ceased to exist, and we'll be working from barges. There's been a lot of effort over the last 15 years to stockpile rock and stone for levee repairs in case we have levee failures. That's a static fix. We won't be using rock and stone to fix levees if they fail seismically. We'll be using barges that we'll be dredging from the river channels, which is currently a violation of environmental laws, and we'll be starting over from scratch for multiple miles. So it's a very different situation, and the fact that we haven't seen it and that it's counterintuitive makes it uphill for policy, but also for simply wrapping your head around it. It's a tough one to deal with. I'm glad you guys sit on that side of the table.
Hank and then Don. I'm sorry, Pat, were you finished?
This is a little bit off the subject, but on the suitability of the geology of the delta to have a 30-mile plus tunnel or two built, what is your view of that?
Are you talking the geologic suitability or the
right.
political suitability?
No.
And my question is
we
very,
all have our roles.
My question is very pointed. It's ideal conditions, and if you get down more than about 70 or so feet, you get below problems like liquefaction, and you'll have firm ground, and you'll have a very survivable system. The trick is getting permission to build it, and then dealing with the multiple interactions, and as everybody along this table pointed out and you guys deal with every day, it's the interactions which make it complicated. The engineering is fairly straightforward.
Okay, Hank, then Don.
It seems to me there's some consensus that if we have a significant earthquake, it's going to damage the levees. Depending on the size and the strength of the earthquake will affect the number of levees that fail. Now, if it comes fairly quickly, there's not much we can do to save property. But we do have an obligation to save lives. And let me ask a dumb question. Do most of these people have boats?
That's my favorite piece of the puzzle. I'd like to talk just for a second about New Orleans. There's a misperception from New Orleans, which has come to California, in terms of policy at the higher levels. My colleague next to me here knows better because he's been out in the field. In New Orleans, the waters that flooded the city were fairly shallow.
Fairly what?
Fairly shallow. There weren't many neighborhoods flooded more than about 6 or 7 feet deep. The Ninth Ward was flooded as much as 14 feet in some places, but most of the water was fairly shallow when you could wade through it chest deep or less in most of the neighborhoods. And it came in from the warm Gulf at 81 degrees, which is warmer than a public swimming pool and not quite as warm as most people's bathtub. People could walk through that water and persist in it for multiple days, and so from Monday through Friday, people walked and swam a bit and saved themselves by the tens of thousands. If we flood California Delta Islands, we'll flood it with water that's probably more like 45 to 55 degrees, and hypothermia will kick in after 20 minutes. The strongest people can't swim. If they can't get themselves up and out of the water, they'll seize up and they'll begin to die. And so we have a very different situation for life safety. In New Orleans, the vast majority of people were not saved by the federal helicopters. They were saved by their neighbors who came back with boats and got them. In the Delta, we're going to want to have boats. Boats are cheap. We already have boats. If they were unstrapped from their trailers, they wouldn't be held down underwater and their electronics wouldn't be ruined. And so existing boats that are tethered to a 30-foot rope with the straps of the trailer unfastened would be a rescue boat if they had gas in their tank. That would be a very achievable thing at very small cost, and it would not be a threat for theft or similar, because you can't steal the boat without the trailer anyway. So there are some inexpensive things that could be done very easily. The price of that would be public awareness and education. If you began instituting a program of documenting and keeping track of who had boats and even putting new boats in neighborhoods that didn't have enough, you would be informing people of the real risk they face, and there are political hurdles to that.
Yeah, I was thinking more lifeboats, or rafts, or the inflatables, or the capon sort of thing.
Yeah, I'm thinking fishing boats and ski boats. We got lots of those in the region,
yeah.
And they would all be available.
You're thinking of a third party coming to rescue a family. I'm thinking of the family being rescued themselves.
I'm thinking of families in neighborhoods that already have boats. Many of these communities have a large
Where
number of boats.
Where are the boats if they have boats?
They're usually in a trailer in the backyard next to their
That's
RV.
Good.
Mr. Baldwin, you ought to weigh in on this part.
Most of the islands that everyone's talking about, they're going to liquefy and fail. They're very rural, thanks to, the limitation on development out there. I think for the rural areas, our experience is those people are pretty savvy. They usually know how to get out. They don't need a boat for the most part, unless they're sitting right next to the levee breach. They know that they move their farm equipment up on the top of the levee, and if they can get up to the top of the levee, they're safe, the problem when you get into that is into the urban areas. Now, we've got a couple of advantages. The urban areas got much better levees, at least in Stockton. But we do have an issue there. And I think the only way you really deal with that is public education goes so far, but I think it's going to take wise evacuation in advance. And hopefully we wouldn't see, in those better levees, the kind of catastrophic failure, and that we'd sort of see it coming in. We'd give the mayor a chance to say, get everyone out of here now. And then at the same time, give them some information as far as the same thing. We were trying to tell people the top of the levee is actually a good place to go. If you think the levee's breached, then get up onto the top of the levee, and it's going to be probably a safe place till we can get to you and get you out, or else get up on your second story and that. I don't see, given the urban boats, we certainly have done pre-planning to make sure we can put boats into the water and do water rescue and air rescue, et cetera, if we have to, but I think that's more the problem. But I think the rurals, our experience when it breaches, they know what to do. They get their stuff up and out, and the people that work out there, and it's a much more manageable problem because there's a lot less people.
Ms. Cosio.
Yeah, if I could make one comment, I think Dr. Seed mentioned that fixing a levee breach could be $90-100 million, and that's the kind of information that I think really should be investigated further, because nowhere in history, including the most expensive, most recent breach at Jones Tract, has it ever cost that much. If you take the emergency operations on Jones Tract, if you take fixing the breach, dewatering the island, fixing the levee that got eroded on the inside while it was flooded, you're not going to get up to $30 million. So I don't know where that information comes from. I know there were lawsuits and everything that happened afterwards, but the actual fixing of a breach is not as expensive as people.
Mr. Baldwin,
before we talk about the cost of that, if there is a significant earthquake, are we going to have a breach in a levee, or is the breach going to be fairly widespread and a very good possibility that the entire damn thing could fall down?
Hit the button on your mic to turn it on, if you would, please.
I want to back up a little bit, because all of a sudden we're immediately into the earthquake. And that's fine. It's an issue of concern, but I'm sort of sitting there, the one person that's actually responsible for the safety of the people in San Joaquin County, and I think the proper approach is looking at a lot of risks to the Delta and limited resources, I think the wise thing is we don't look at just the earthquake. We look at the range of risks, and you start with what's happened, not the hypothetical ones, what actually has happened that we have experience on, and has the highest probability, and you kind of work up to the lower probability issues. Then you separate the lower probability issues into the ones that they're unlikely to happen, but they have happened, and we have some experience, and they're unlikely to happen, and still it's somewhat hypothetical. I'm not challenging Dr. Seeds, but we just don't know. And, so you have to kind of put it up there. And then what I do is, with limited resources, we've got to go back down, let's get back down to the flood, The Central Valley flood and getting prepared for that, keeping in mind these bigger scenarios, less likely events, events that we don't really absolutely sure, despite all the modeling, exactly what would happen, and work our way up. It concerns me that we jump right up into the earthquake. Yes, it's of concern, but I think it's more just more justice to the people of Delta to start with what we know is probably going to happen, has a higher probability. Get ready for that. There's a lot that we need to do that, keeping in mind the other scenarios, and then eventually work up to where we start to address those. Sometimes we get a little mesmerized by the really slick video outlining this and start taking it for reality. And all I'm saying is that I don't know exactly what happened. I've been surprised too many times to say I can predict exactly how things will happen when certain things happen. But I really want us to concentrate on what has a high probability happening, has happened. We need to do more there. Let's get that ready. And then once we're ready for that, you know, we move on to these other scenarios and start to address them. And
yeah, I think none of those things are mutually exclusive. We can do them all. But I think the one that has the most catastrophic outcome would be an earthquake. And I appreciate the fact we haven't dealt with an earthquake. And then your experience is dealing with other things. But in terms of cost of lives, you know, a significant earthquake kind of trumps everything else in terms of concern. The other ones would be fairly gradual. A flood, there'd be warning and all the rest of that. But
well,
an earthquake that hits, you know, hard and quick is something we haven't dealt with. And because of the catastrophic result, I think we have to think about that. Not at the exclusion of the other stuff, but think about that.
Say don't think about it. What concerns me is it seems to be the only subject of discussion, and I think you start with the flood. Like I said, I think more needs to be done there, and I think we just keep a little element of skepticism that we're so smart that we know exactly what will happen in the future. We can spend because you know the dynamics of the total failure, which may happen, is totally different than a flood. And if we sort of zero on that, we end up with this response system that's maybe good for the earthquake or the potential of the total failure. And not with what is going to happen day to day and what we're going to actually end up seeing maybe in the next 10 or 20 years as opposed to the other. So I'm just saying, I'm not downplaying
it. If you can guarantee
like
we're not
going to
see an earthquake in the next 10 to 20 years, then I'll buy what you're saying.
Well, I'm not saying we won't have an earthquake. I don't know what will happen when that earthquake comes as far as what's in the Delta. And all I'm saying is that we do have a lot of information and there's a lot that needs to be done for flood planning that we can do that will benefit us if we have the catastrophic earthquake. It just concerns me sometimes that we jump right straight to the catastrophic earthquake and the whole issue of what will probably happen, you know, a major flood down the valley gets
okay,
kind of...
Okay, look, we've got to get members' questions. So hold up just for a minute.
I think I can reunite us. I think a lot of the preparations that you would make for seismic rescue would be parallel and very similar to static rescue. And I think if we had places for people to get up on upper stories of buildings and so on, if we had the ability to bring boats or have boats available, all those kinds of things are useful for both. So I don't think they're orthogonal. I think the preparation for one is good preparation for the other. Not necessarily comprehensive, but good.
Life vest might be another alternative.
Don Natoli, Gloria Gray.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to make a comment before I ask my question that I think we need to be realistic, but I also... it concerns me a bit that we paint this kind of grim picture, and certainly you can do all kinds of scenarios, and that's what planning is about, is to plan for scenarios that maybe the least expected as well as those that might be more expected at times. And I think some of the responses to my colleagues' questions kind of bear out certainly, I think, distinction in the sense that when we talk about the Delta and we talk about the legal Delta and then the secondary and primary zones, there are some important distinctions. I think certainly Ron and his comments, and I think both Mike and Gil in their comments pointed to that as well, is that you've got this distinction, and I think it's an important distinction because it talks about population and property values and risk to greater numbers of people and certainly greater financial risk as well. And I think it's really important because when you look at the primary zone of the Delta and you look at, you know, certainly the more rural setting there and the challenges that are faced there on year-to-year flood fights, let alone the unexpected of a seismic event or something else that might occur of a more catastrophic nature, I think it's really important to use that as, you know, as some framework. And as we're doing our work here, I think I would just, again, put out the point. I think we need to keep that in mind. And you look at the secondary zone and some of the whether you call it encroachment or development that's occurred there, and then obviously the broader legal delta, which takes in, you know, existing urban developed areas. And I guess my question to some of the panelists, and anybody can take it, but I know it was talked to, I think, in a couple of the papers here, is the issues of, and I kind of bring this back to the kind of the current setting and looking for the next 10 or 20 years, even to Hank's question, is that we've got work going on in the urban setting, but we have you know, hundreds and hundreds of miles of rural levees, but I think the criticality of them is relevant as well. And so the issues of permitting, of even if you had all the dollars there, and I know that, you know, Dave and Gil and others have been before us in the past and said, you know, there's money there, but how can you realistically get the work done? Permitting, the issue of dredging, and I think, you know, how those fit into the framework of some of the things, the work that's been done, but continuing the work at a pace that allows us to continue to address the risk factors, recognizing that if you're looking to deal with the earthquake that might occur, that some of the work will fit into that, but you're not, you know, there's no way in the next 10 or 20 years, even if we're given the money, that you're going to be able to do that, and do you want to do that? I think that's the point that's been raised here. So I guess I would ask the panelists to kind of maybe give a take on this permitting and the benefits and or not of dredging. And the third piece of that is, as it relates to the levee standards, you know, there's a lot of focus on the urban setting, but if we don't get some acceptance around, you know, some of the standards that protect life and property and a way of life, whether it's agriculture or recreation or environmental assets, and get some agreement around that fairly quickly, and then allow folks that are in the Delta doing that work to do that. And so I guess my question is three-pronged, the dredging, the permitting, and this standard that would allow work to go forward and with some expectation that we can continue to make significant progress and recognize that without getting all bundled up and everything else that's going on, including the work of this council. So I don't know who wants to take that.
Well, I'll take the first shot at it. I think what you're hitting on is kind of one of the main problems I have with the way the process has gone. In the Delta, we've got a hierarchy of needs, and we start at ground zero. When I started here in 84, these levees were really bad. You know, they're 2 feet or so lower than they are now, so narrow you could barely drive on them, and most of them were so overgrown and had no gravel roads, so you really couldn't drive on them during the winter. So we've taken care of some of those basic issues and gotten to kind of a minimal level of protection. It doesn't meet any current engineering standards, but it's got some free ward, and the levee's a little bit bigger. And so our next step is to, you know, see where we go from there. So then we're hit with this process, which included Dreams and some of the others, that said, well, by the way, these levees are so bad, they're never going to stand up in earthquakes. Let's abandon them. Well, in my mind as an engineer, you take that information and you don't just come to a final conclusion. You look at, okay, what's the risk of these things failing? And if it's truly a $50 billion risk to the water system of California, then maybe it's worth a little investment. And I mean little in the billions, not millions, but no one's ever taken that step. And given us information, okay, it's worth it on Sherman Island and Twitchell Island and Webb Track to do a seismic repair because we've got this analysis. You engineers go ahead and design it. Over on Brack Track on the northeastern side of the Delta, hey, we don't need seismic flood control. So we've never been given that direction because we've jumped, kind of like Ron said, from nothing to, oh, my God, we've got to do the earthquake. And that's not the case. I think every levee is got to be looked at and determine whether this system is a flood control system or is it worth building up a seismic resistance system. Back to your main question, as far as dredging, for the most part, that's not the most ideal way of getting material. In the lower delta, the hydraulics of the channels don't control, it's the tide, and so it's not going to improve your flood elevations, and the material down there is not real good material. We have a lot of contractors in this area that are eager to work on these levees. I get calls almost daily, you know, where's the money? Where's the money? What are we going to do? And these guys aren't sitting on their hands waiting for us to put out projects. They're talking to landowners. They're getting ready to file SMARA permit requests to borrow material. There's millions and millions of yards of material out there, good material, very close to the Delta Islands we can ship and place on a levee for very inexpensive. It's just a matter of knowing that the money's out there and we've got a plan. Once they see that, we're going to get a huge economy building that'll help us work on these levees. And the work on these levees is on the land side, so we don't have a lot of the permitting issues that are just going to stop a project as we would maybe on the water side. There are going to be some issues with giant garter snake and some of the land-based type issues that we'll have to do some best management practices, but we can deal with those.
Mr. Baldwin.
I just want to make a quick observation. You know, I'm not here to justify the building of the Delta and levees that people did 100 years ago and potentially put people at risk. I'm not here to justify the building of the University of California, Berkeley, on the most dangerous earthquake fault in North America and putting people at risk. I'm trying to protect people's life and safety, and you notice we're an hour into this, and we haven't even talked about issues about responding and protecting people's lives and property. We jumped right immediately into either levee standards, which is important, or whether the Delta should be, you know, part left and part big, or the catastrophic earthquake that's going to flatten everything immediately, you know. And we got issues where we could be better at flood fighting and saving people's lives and property, and yet every document that comes out of, whether it's Delta Vision on up, has been this concentration on the other issues, which I know are important. And when it comes to risk, it's either levee standards, or should we abandon parts of the Delta or whatever, or we go right to the catastrophic earthquake that's going to flatten all the levees, which leaves us with really nothing except rescue, you know. And the only thing I'd like the council to realize, again, in my opening statement, is that if you really we can improve safety. Maybe when the earthquake comes down the road and Dr. Seed's, you know, theory comes out, and I'm not denying that could potentially happen, but, you know, we're going to have floods too, and we could, the odds say we're going to have big floods before that, and certainly the risk is higher, or the odds of probabilities. And we need to get some help in making some fundamental changes, and if the council isn't going to delve into that in some depth, you're going to get superficialities like you've gotten in the past. You're going to tinker with the system like the Central Valley Flood Control Plan and others are doing, and you're not going to really address some of the fundamental changes that I tried to mention in my two-page. So I just make an observation that I always feel like, you know, we just jump right into these other issues that just push away the actual emergency planning and the really serious problems and issues that and barriers that we have to making that better. So.
Okay, Ms. Gray, then Ms. Marcus, then Mr. Fiorini. Oh, I'm sorry, Don, excuse me.
I want to see if anybody else wanted to respond, if I could, Mr. Chair. I think Dave and a couple were going to respond, or Mike, if I could just hear from them, it would be helpful.
I'd like to follow up on what Ron did. I think we have to be careful not to let the hypothetical dry policy using public safety as the excuse to be able to pursue other goals. If we're going to be talking about public safety, we ought to be talking about it, of which these other seismic issues are a component of trying to deal with it, but it shouldn't be focused as the component on the table.
I can try to be really quick here. We've heard this debate for over a decade. Should we be worrying about the seismic earthquake and the levees failing there, or can we fix the levees and respond to sea level rise? And I think both people on both sides, particularly Gilbert, make some really good cases. I think what we need to do is hope for the best and assume the worst. And in the interim, we need to be investing in what Gilbert wants to do in terms of bolstering levees, because we're not going to have a backup for the water supply. So for the next 20 years, let's move as quickly as we can in terms of doing the minimum things that Gilbert is talking about. But in terms of protecting people, let's not just think about emergency response. We need to assume the worst. We need to assume that maybe the Delta is going to look like Lake Pontchartrain, and there will be wind wave fetches across the Delta with big waves. So what happens if Jersey Island and Bethel Island fail? Will it be a good idea to have 5,000 people in three public schools on Hotchkiss Tract below sea level? Will it be a good idea to have Spanos Park West, buffering waves below sea level? From a land use perspective, I think we really need to assume the worst in terms of what's going to happen and really keep people off any development below sea level. And if they are, by the way, I have much more detailed comments on specific things you can do on the building code to make sure that if there is building below sea level, that people aren't dependent on Ron Baldwin or a boat, but there are other things that can make sure that the built environment will protect them.
Ms. Gray, Ms. Marcus, Mr. Fiorini.
Good morning. You know, for me, this is probably the most important topic in our plan because it does affect both of our co-equal goals. And obviously there are a lot of projects, especially on the local level and others that are trying to protect life and property. I'd like to look at it from a perspective. What can we do right now to really improve on what we're doing, to coordinate whatever efforts are out there? Because it's going to take a long time for any kind of new regulations or new things to happen to protect people. So what can we do right now to coordinate what is going on out there and really address it? Because obviously when you look at the news this morning about what happened in Japan, it could happen tomorrow, whether it's an earthquake or whether it's flooding. So what can we do to improve on what we now have to address an issue that may happen?
Are you talking about emergency response, or are you talking about
emergency response, whether it's flooding or
look at the second page of Mr. Baldwin's handout, which has six ideas as a start.
Okay, that I just gave you. Oh, Felicia, I just gave it to Felicia.
It's prefatory to that. Let me say, I mean, if I'm putting you in my position. You're the emergency response manager for San Joaquin County, and you're going to have to deal with a flood. The first thing you got to do is you got to realize there's two different aspects. Everyone says flood response, and you see evacuation and helicopters hovering and stuff. Two key differences. Flood fight operations. That's those operations intended once the flood comes and all the designers are done and the hydrologists are done. That's the flood fight operations to try to prevent the levee from failing. And if a levee does fail, trying to limit the extent and the depth and the duration of the flood to limit the damage. Then the other component is those things that you more naturally think of, you know, evacuation, rescue, the helicopter plucking people off. Now, why do I divide it into two different things? For two reasons. Totally different players in each aspect. Totally different barriers to getting better. Totally different systems and processes as far as how it happens. Second reason I divide it is the flood fight operation is prime directive number one. If we have the best flood response system to the levees, if we know that most effectively, if a levee does breach, we can limit that extent to the most humanly possible, we can get it out as quickly as possible, then we have prevented the tragedy. The evacuation, the shelter, that just ameliorates the tragedy. So it keeps us focused on that's what we have to do better, is we have to, once the flood comes up, be able to respond to problems on the levees, fix them. Mm-hmm. Those can be done. You know, barring, you know, once we get to the earthquake scenario where everything liquefies, maybe it changes, and that's an issue we're going to have to deal with down the road. But right now, with most of the floods and what we see, is we can flood fight those levees. And if there's a breach, then what we can do is we can try to limit that. And what we found is several problems. The flood fight's getting very expensive. We have a system based on the old Sims, et cetera, and the idea of local control. We end up coming in and flood fighting those problems. You know, we have some key players, DWR, the Corps of Engineers, the locals, obviously the reclamation districts, and yet we're all kind of flood fighting it and coming up with the money separately. So what we end up with is we go out there and we have this big discussion, who's going to do what? And we sort of have an upside down response system, where funding system, where the district kind of throws its hands up real quick because it doesn't have the money, and then it kicks up to higher bureaucracies and it slows it down. We're also not doing, we could handle the funding better to get the people at the lowest level to deal with these problems much more quickly, and I think that's what I tried to identify in here. We could also start moving to more of a regional system where we see regional control at a higher level, and this is not something that the California is used to. They'll say, yeah, we have regional systems. They're talking about mutual aid and sharing information, et cetera. But the idea that somebody at a regional level has some command, is San Joaquin County, to a certain extent, you must conform to a bigger picture, not just kind of deal with your own issues, doesn't exist. We haven't been going out, and I brought a couple of examples. I mean, like I said, we just kind of wait for the flood to come, and then in the middle of the night we're discussing, well, what do we do now? The levee breached, you know, what should we do? We're not collecting. I remember one of my first floods, and we thought it was going to break out of the Stanislaus. I said, well, where's the water go if it does break out? And they said, well, we don't know. We've never collected that information. You know, we kind of get mesmerized by the levee. We put our efforts into that primary levee, and then, you know, we kind of forget behind the levee. We're not going out and collecting a lot of information that would be really critical to containing that flood. You know, we've been out doing our flood contingency maps, doing things, common sense stuff, getting surveys of old dry land levees, you know, collecting information behind it. We're getting the as-builts from Caltrans on our elevated freeways. You know, you don't just dig those out of a vault in 10 minutes. You know?
So, Ron, can I ask you a question? Yeah. What can the council do
And I want to kind of loop back to some of the discussion yesterday that Chris and Joe were picking up on. If they're thinking about what could be in the Delta plan that would potentially be viewed as regulatory or as opposed to making recommendations to the Department of Water Resources or elsewhere. I think the council members are really interested in knowing what could be in the plan. And, Chris, if you have thought in this area, in fact, I know you've thought about this, but...
I have a bit. And I think that in this case, they may go hand in hand.
Mr. Stevens, our lawyer, for those who have not met him yet.
Let me read to you something that may set the context for what you're talking about, Mike. And this is actually from an important bill analysis that was done with respect to the Delta Reform Act. And I'll read you the paragraph on levees and flood protection. And this goes to our role and what we can do. And this was, I don't always typically go to the bill analysis first, but I think in this case it does put it in context. It says, the bill, the Delta Reform Act, requires the Delta plan to reduce risks to people, property, and state interests in the Delta with emergency preparedness, appropriate land uses, and strategic levee investments. And that's in the Act. We've seen that. The Delta plan will include recommendations for priorities for state investments and levees. These recommendations, in combination with the Council's authority to ensure that state agencies act consistently with the Delta plan, will ensure that levee spending by DWR and the Central Valley Flood Protection Board reflects these priorities. It goes on to say, the legislature generally does not appropriate funding to specific Delta levee projects and has not succeeded in imposing priorities on state levee spending in the Delta. Instead, the state budget leaves the discretion to DWR and the Central Valley Flood Protection Board to determine how to spend state money on both levees in the state plan of flood control and non-project levees. These priorities will affect both the Delta Levee Subvention Program, non-project levees, and the Special Projects Program, levees with a state interest. So I think, in essence, the intent here was that through the identification of strategic levy investments and working together with some of our state agencies to come up with priorities, that together that could be seen as what you're talking about, something that has regulatory effect. And the idea is that this august body will set these kinds of priorities and standards, and that covered actions, the way that it's defined in the Act, that come before this body, for instance, the DWR subvention program, if there's grant funding involved, would have to be consistent with what you set. So in essence, it's not the typical direct primary regulatory that we think of in terms of permitting, and that's consistent with what I spoke of yesterday about this agency not being a super regulatory body. It doesn't trump the direct permitting agencies, but it does have regulatory authority by virtue of the standards it sets and through the consistency process. So with that, I will turn it back over to you.
If I can, on discussion about the Delta Levees program, since those are under my management, subventions and special projects both do need to have some expectations of them. One of the things that the council can do is to take a look and make certain that when the department is doing their flood management work, that we carry that work through not just the project levees, but all the way out to the Carquinez Strait. We have a tendency to focus, as we probably should, on life and property, and of course that means the project levees. So within the Delta, you have an interest not only in life and property, but routing the flood all the way to a place where it is no longer damaging to your interests. You have an existing system that works very, very well for you. That partnership between the Reclamation District and the state is, I think, one of the things that has worked, has demonstrated its value, and can continue to work well as long as it's not hamstrung by additional regulations and over-expectation for you have to monitor everything. You have to do it according to prevailing wage. You have to dot every I and cross every T with each one of the regulations. And, oh, by the way, you need to come back two or three times to get the level of permitting and permissions that are necessary to go to work, because we just want to take a look at what you're doing. So that kind of, I'll call it over-regulation, is something that I would really encourage you to avoid, and I see it creeping in already. Facilitate the work that's needed to operate and maintain and improve those levees. Don't make it harder. I'll stop.
So, Ron, here, let's talk about preparedness and flood fight and
okay,
what the council can do around those things.
Number one, flood contingency maps. Not a lot of money. We spent maybe $300,000, $400,000. We went out, surveyed levees. We sit down and we came up with options. These floods aren't mysteries. We know if the levee breaches here that we can make a relief cut, we can block a highway underpass, et cetera. Trouble is, you have to prepare in advance. The fact is, we could go even further. We completed these plans. We said if the levee breaches here, we can do this, 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 and we'll help contain the flood, lower the depth or whatever. We could actually have it pre-planned. We could go to the state and say, hey, if this happens, instead of a 48-hour argument about who's going to do what, you agree now that you're going to block the freeways and the Corps will make the relief cut. And I mean, it could be scripted. Now, can I get that done? I'd only mention 2 points, is I can't get the state or the Corps to actually do that. They won't even acknowledge the maps because what I'm being told is the liability. Oh, we don't want to take a risk. So we can't get to that point that we could have this scripted, you know. And second, to date, I haven't gotten a dime of state money or bond money to help with this. You know, we've done this on our own with local monies, collected information and done it. We can do the flood contingency maps. The floods aren't mysteries. We can see it in advance. We could have this pre-planned instead of 48 hours. We can change the funding. You know, we get out to Jones Track. Well, you know, they got some inventions, but that's $250,000. Psh, that goes like that. All of a sudden, DWR is arguing with the Department of Finance. And the district throws up its hands. And you say, well, the district ought to have more money, but there's a lot of beneficiaries of the Delta out there that aren't paying the districts any money to help with levy emergency response. And so that might not be a totally valid argument, but the reality is. And then, what happened for 20-some years is what DWR would do is, oh, they just went to Sugar Daddy. They just PL-99 request to the Corps. And the Corps was getting really fed up for many years and saying, look it, you know, you're just going straight to us for everything, you know, and we're tired. The state ought to throw something into here. And so there's this budget quandary, you know, who's going to pay and all that kind of stuff. Now, DWR's gotten a lot better, and in 2006 they happened to have some money, and they threw it in there. We can do it, but why not take it all out? We've got an opportunity to maybe make a response fund, get it out of these budgets and all this budget quandary and the arguments, get the fund there, set up a system for its use, and then empower the people closer to the problem, you know, get some unified commands, get past this thing about what agency, and say, let's put the people down here. We got the flood. We know what's going to happen, you know, how to deal with this, what needs to be done. We've collected the information. Let's get a better command system down here where we can respond quickly, and we haven't got people in the field that got to go back to Sacramento to get approval from three levels up, or a county that feels that because for 100 years it hasn't had any role, it shouldn't be throwing some money at this levee flood fight. I'm not putting it all in the state. It's all of us, you know. We could get people down there that have the plans, that doesn't cost a lot of money. We get a different funding system so we don't have these budget quandaries and these arguments and people arguing with finance and stuff of who's going to do it. And we can start getting more efficient and get past it. Now, what it does mean is that we kind of have to violate a little bit, and we have to change things about the way the state is. And, you know, big bureaucracies are real conservative. They're going to shout me down, oh, that's not SIMS, et cetera. You know, we've kind of gone from an innovative system 15 years ago, and believe me, I've seen it all, to more like dogma. You know, well, you can't do that. You know, this is SIMS, and it's like the monks arguing how many angels can stand on the head of a pin. All interesting, but not really relevant to the mission. You know, we can do it, but it's going to take some big changes, and that's tough to push through. The council could assist with that, you know. Some of it's not that hard. I think DWR, everyone would agree. I'd love to see somebody give me some money to help with the flood contingency maps, but they all agree it's a good thing. The Corps is putting some money into it. as we speak. We can change the command system so that, lower down where the people are on the scene, whether it's a DWR person or a district person, can actually act. And we're not sitting there having this argument of who's got the money and who's willing to act and do something. I'll mention one silly thing.
One more thing.
One more thing.
Okay.
One more thing. One silly thing. You know, FEMA. In Jones Track, we got a problem. You know, we have to build up this levee, et cetera. The Corps says, I'll do this. And so Caltrans steps up and says, you know, we're going to come in. We've decided this is Highway 4. We're going to put the rock there. We're going to spend several million dollars. We see this all the time. FEMA has a regulation, you know, when they come in on a disaster and say, we'll only reimburse you funds for those things that you're legally responsible for, your jurisdiction. So when the county goes into the levee, which is not our legal jurisdiction, and saves it, we actually get penalized by FEMA regulation as far as our reimbursement capabilities. You know, we have these silly things in place that stops the lowest level from responding and dealing with these issues, and I think we could remove those. We could change it. We could change the funding. We can go out and do the simple things that just have been a neglect. Collect information, do the pre-planning. We could be brave enough to accept that we're all going to cost some money and pre-commit to responding and doing some of these things. And I think we could have a much more efficient system, but it's going to take some push, and I don't even know if the council's got enough push to do it. But that's where you could help.
Thanks,
okay,
Ron.
Ms. Marcus, then Mr. Fiorini.
No, I enjoy just an observation.
And get a little closer to the mic, please.
An observation and then a couple of questions for whoever can answer them. One is, I love what you're talking about. I have been through flood fights and earthquake response at the local and the federal level in past lives, but it was a large municipality where it was easy to draw the attention. You had a high-profile mayor. The president showed up. And even then, I saw both the best and the worst of what you're talking about, but I completely agree with you about the preparation. I love your suggestions. I did not realize how dispersed it was in the Delta, and to anything we can do to bring higher profile and then hopefully action on preparing in a coordinated and elimination of the petty little ridiculous squabbles and things that keep us from doing our best together. I'm with you. And whether we have regulatory authority or not, I think we have this interesting twofer of having some things we can have regulatory authority about, but we have a pulpit on which we can make recommendations in a way that people will see and listen to, and activists can work on, and we can draw in feds and elected officials.
Felicia, they're having trouble hearing you. So.
Oh, I'm sorry. I always hate talking into these things. So I can see something that can come out of it, and I really do appreciate your recommendations, your passion, and your experience, because I know what that feels like, incident command and everybody. The more prep you do, the better. People know who's going to do what, and I'm all for that. So I you know, my recommendation will be that we have a very large recommendation on that front. I do also think that you do have to do both, that you definitely have to prepare for the things that are likeliest to happen and have happened before, but we have to look at the big catastrophic thing as well. We have a 100-year view we're supposed to be taking. I would bet something, even my house probably, that or my condo, I don't have a house, we will have a major earthquake in that planning horizon, if not the next 10 to 20 years. I mean, I'd bet a lot that it will happen. So we also need to be preparing for that in a big way. So I think it's a both and part of the conversation here sounded like an either or, and the either or comes out of the fact that there are limited resources. So I agree with that. We need to figure out a way to make that pot of resources bigger by drawing attention to both sets of the issues. So I can see the construct of a series of recommendations that might come out of that. My questions, and I'll be very supportive. The two questions that are somewhat related but actually different. One is, and again, I apologize for coming late. I just couldn't be helped with my day gig. I had just had something that had to be done this morning at my job. But can somebody or someone's, I know a lot of you have expertise, talk a little bit about the water quality and water supply aspects of a large catastrophic failure in terms of the water going south? I mean, people with a brush, Richard, you may well know from all the BDCP work, you know, talk about the impact of a massive collapse on water going south. I haven't heard as much about that. I'm a later comer to the council. You may have spent a lot of time on it, but I would love a little bit of discussion on that from whoever can respond, because there's also it's the state interest piece of what we're looking at that I'm not sure how to fit into this. The second thing I'd really love to hear from Dr. Seed is, you know, you've walked all those places where you've seen all of this. I'd love an example, perhaps other than Holland, which I know a fair amount about, but an example of a place that had this sort of a catastrophic set of failures and what they did about it and what happened. Did they totally change what was there before? Did they rebuild? And I'm a narrative story person. So if you could just tell a couple of stories from those places also, that would be good. So those are my two questions.
Let me do the second one first because it's easier.
Then Dave.
The answer is no, because what typically happens, and Japan's a good example, they've had from 64 to present, probably at least 5 earthquakes I can think of where they've had significant levee damages, and Japan still does not have realistic seismic levee standards. They just let them fail and fix them. They fix them all. But the interesting thing to note about that is that most levees aren't like delta levees. Most levees are dry or have low water at their toe most of the time, so they're essentially not working levees. Delta levees are more properly dikes because they're actually wet every day and they get a high tide twice a day. So the delta levees are constantly loaded, even if it's not an unusually high water condition. So the risk level is significantly higher there. To go back to your other question, the water quality consequences of widespread levee failures are currently much under debate. BDCP has concluded that if you were to salinate the delta and create essentially a shallow brackish situation with holes and levees, it would eventually flush itself out if you let the water continue to flow. The DRMS hydraulic studies reached a different conclusion, and I haven't yet had a chance to see the BDCP's underlying assumptions, but I'm told they're looking at holes and levees, which would be different from long continuous reaches being damaged, and that's a common perceptive error. The hydrologists on both teams are outstanding. But if they were told to deal with holes in levees as opposed to damaged sections of levees, the answers would change. So we're not very clear on the water quality ramifications, but the bottom line is it's very hard to pass Sacramento River water to the south portion of the delta through a damaged region which is having tidal fluxes moving salt back and forth through breaches. You pretty much need to have confined channel flow to have fresh enough water. And the last piece of that is the water quality issue is one of the most fascinating because water quality means different things to different people. Water quality for export is, you know, Heidi and the Swiss Alps with, you know, fresh snow melt. And water quality for ecosystems is often variably brackish water with green slimy sludge in it. So it's a different kind of a thing, and we have to be careful about what kinds of quality we maintain where.
No, that's a great point. If anybody who's gone to the Everglades and you go with a biologist and they tell you what's beautiful water, you know that that's a very different view of water. Yeah.
Mr. Grindstaff, Mr. Brandt's on this question.
I just wanted to say that this is a really important issue, and our plan is at the next council meeting to bring in people to talk about those studies about what happens in the event of a catastrophic failure, because there was a study that at BDCP I think funded, but anyway, there was one study that says that you could recover from a catastrophic event in 4 months versus the study that Dreams did that said it was something like 2 years, as I recall. And so, and David's here, he can answer that. But the plan is to actually bring in some of the real parties and have them talk about those issues.
Dave?
Thank you. With respect to water quality effects and what happens to export, I think probably one of the better examples might be the failure of Brannan Andrus in 1972. The island failed in a relatively dry year, late in the year. It brought in brackish water into the delta, and the water quality was such that the pumping system shut down. The pumps were off for several weeks. The water was salt water was trapped in the central delta, and they had a really hard time getting it out. Fresh water in the amount of about 500,000 acre feet was used to flush that brackish water, and still some lower quality water was moved down through the aqueduct system and mixed with groundwater to make it usable. The DREAM study showed that the water system could be shut down by any number of events.
depending upon the type of water year, whether it's a wet, dry, or normal, the time of year. In the wintertime, the water quality is generally good throughout the whole delta, so a failure in the middle of winter might not give you any problems with the water supply system at all. In the summertime, the amount of water that's coming into the delta is much less, and a failure can give you problems. The length of time that the system is down is really where you gather the big economic effects. I think there was a six-month outage was the Dreams version, and there was something like $40 billion worth of effects, and that's economic impacts and as
that's about 1.2% of the gross state product annually of California.
Yeah. So I think since that time, the folks that are working in the water supply industry have figured out that they can do some things to bring the delta back from a catastrophic event much more quickly than we had during Dreams. Now, there were a number of assumptions that were made in the Dreams analysis that need to be tested, and we have an opportunity to do that with I'll call it DKIP, Delta Knowledge Improvement Program, because we realized that we were under the time gun and we had to move forward with the study on a regular basis. So some of the assumptions that we made are no longer true, but there is a mechanism in place to handle that. Love to talk about it if the time is right and at the right opportunities.
Okay. All right. I think Mr. Roos Collins, what?
And at some point, Mr. Chairman, we'll get Richard's overarching comments as well.
Yes.
I was thinking.
Yes.
We'll work with you on that.
Mr. Chair, let me address briefly Ms. Marcus's question about the BDCP. The Department of Water Resources and Reclamation have conducted many studies on the water quality risk that you described. But as to the design, my understanding is the BDCP is designed to move the primary point of diversion north of that risk, and more specifically, upslope of that risk. So when you have your presentation, check on that. But that is a risk management strategy. The other strategy, which is not in the working draft of the BDCP, and you should consider, is frankly, more a local contingency supply. If Met were here, they would tell you they've built 1 million acre-feet of additional storage in their service area in the past decade. That's the strategy I'm talking about, and it shouldn't just be Met. It should be everyone who is potentially affected by the risk you describe.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Fiorini.
I appreciate all of your input, and it's great to hear from so many experts. The Delta plan that we're responsible for producing will be divided up into chapters, and we'll touch on risk management. The flow of the chapters will begin with findings or facts that will lead to policy statements that will lead to recommendations. So my question for each one of you is, and looking at an event like the 97 flooding or the Jones Track, we certainly learned some things from those kinds of events. Help us with either a policy statement or your top recommendation that should feed into the Delta plan. And I'd like to begin with John and just work our way across. What would be your number one policy statement or your number one recommendation as it relates to risk management?
I have to pick only one. I'll behave.
If number two is really good, you can pick two.
Or in writing after the meeting.
Or it could be a bumper sticker or a mantra, either one.
The finding would be that residual risk behind levees is very high. And that emergency response, while sufficient, while necessary and critical, is not sufficient the policy statement should be some sort of regulatory action to manage those residual risks, and the recommendations would be everything from land use controls to building codes to make sure that the people who live on those in those areas are, number one, aware of the risk, and number two, are less vulnerable. And one very specific one would be some sort of real estate disclosure notice that everyone who buys a home behind a levee, regardless of whether it's FEMA accredited or not, knows at the time of signing how deep their property would flood in a flood event. Number two, the finding would be, and this has been done, first phase of the Central Valley Flood Management Planning Process did an excellent job of articulating the problems in the Delta and the Central Valley Flood Management plan or system. And the finding is that there is not enough conveyance capacity in the Central Valley Flood system to safely convey floodwaters from terminal reservoirs to the Delta. The policy statement should be we should work to expand the ability to safely convey those floodwaters to the Delta, and the recommendation should be to immediately divert some of these Prop 1E monies and 84 monies towards expanding two or three bypasses in the Delta. In the Delta.
Great. Dave?
Thank you. I'll be real short. The recommendation that I think the Delta plan should prepare and put forth is to preserve the existing partnership and provide a stable, adequate funding source for levee operation, maintenance, and improvement. One other thing, John just mentioned that there's insufficient capacity to, in the flood supply system or flood prevention system, to route flows to the Delta. I don't think that's in your best interest. I think what you want is to make sure that the system is adequate to route flows through the Delta and beyond.
Gil?
Well, since Dave tackled the levee maintenance funding, I'll throw out a policy statement that concerns a disaster assistance and procedures. First, I'll give you an example of one of the procedures we have set up. After the 86 flood, FEMA was very tired of coming in and helping us after floods in 80, 82, 83, 80, actually we had two in 83, and then 86. And so they said, in order for us to come in and help you, we're going to sign a memorandum of understanding that these reclamation districts are going to raise their levees to a minimum level. So that was the carrot they kind of hung out there for us to attain. And if they do this, then we'll come in and help you during disaster, which included the state as a signatory because they're a cost-share partner during that disaster. And so since that time, we've got this memorandum of understanding that if we keep our levy at a certain level, we know that FEMA's going to, theoretically know that FEMA's going to come in and help us during a disaster. Now, the amount of work we can do is limited because it's a reimbursement program to what we can finance, so it's certainly not going to help us in a levy breach or something that the district can never finance. So the policy statement I would have would be that commensurate with the importance of a certain island, the state and or federal governments will enter into agreements to assist the locals with emergency procedures and operations with some sort of memorandum of understanding.
Mike?
I can concur with John in terms of the residual risk, but I think I would differ in terms of the idea of maintaining the partnership. I think we need to modify the partnership between the state and the locals and recognize the need to incorporate locals into a regional response team. And contrary where Chris indicated that it ought to be a discussion with the state, there also ought to be a discussion with the locals in developing this regional response. You need to have the coordination of the of regional efforts, much in the same way we're starting to look at integrated regional water management plans. We should be looking at the same thing for regional public safety.
Mr. Baldwin.
Sorry. The bold vision is obviously two things I would do. Number one, you finish the flood contingency maps and the corollary urban evacuation maps. You collect the information. You do the pre-planning. You look at the breach scenarios. and you tell the state of California, and to the extent we can influence the Corps of Engineers and the counties and the reclamation districts, that you will sit down and pre-plan this and you will pre-commit, because we know we're all in this together. If we all don't come in together right away, we're not going to be as efficient as possible in containing these floods if we do breach, or in holding the levees. And you pre-commit to it. You know, we'll just bite the bullet that we're all going to be in this. We're not going to pretend we're not, and liability or not, we're going to finish this. We're going to do it. Second is I get the funding for that flood fight response, the levy, the containing the flood, out of the agency budgets, get into a special fund, and empower people at the local level, which could include state reps, could include, but people, so we aren't running back to Sacramento or Washington, D.C., or the county courthouse trying to get permission to do things. Empower those people to use those funds to respond per the plan, and I think you'd see less flooding, and you'd see smaller floods, and we'd be better off. I would add one last thing, is the SB 27 report is coming out. It's in the state hands of the state bureaucracy, so I can never answer for it, although if they change it at higher levels, San Joaquin County will not sign on it. But as it is written now, most of the elements of this, I think, will be supported by my counterparts. And DWR people are on that committee, as well as CalEMA personnel. So,
Mr. C.
Well, I guess I get to wrap up, which is nice, because I liked all of those, and some of them would have been perhaps my first choice. So I'll go broad brush with the end. I think I would produce a finding that the risks, plural, in the Delta are unconscionable for a modern society, and the values embedded in the Delta are under-recognized, and the result of that as a policy issue would be I would look for more sustainable funding to support the Delta in many ways, and I would look for a stable and fair governance to implement those resources. And I would make that more of a priority. I think that we tend to myopically put Delta stuff on Delta inhabitants. We put water stuff on water users, and we tend not to recognize that perhaps the state economy and the nation's economy may hang in the balance, and there are services being provided to people who don't even realize they're getting services, just like many people who live behind a levee. Last time the survey was done at the state level, didn't know that they were protected by a levee. So I would look for a global upgrading of attention and resources commensurate with the scale and the importance of the problems and the issues.
I find this the most puzzling, and everyone wants, we have a mandatory duty to recommend or to try to adopt a prioritization on levy funding. And let me tell you, here's how I'm kind of thinking of it. I think there's a fundamental difference in view of what that description means if you're a Delta resident or a property owner, and if you're sitting on a state commission with the co-equal goals statewide. And I think really this is a classic situation where we spend more time talking about money than about policy, because in government, all policy is spelled M-O-N-E-Y. That's all we talk about. We are in a economic downturn. It's going to continue. The political mood to raise taxes is not great. Even for disaster prevention, I think the chances of a stable and secure funding source for any governmental program is not easy to guarantee at all times. That's my personal opinion. But the thing that puzzles me is to how we should deal with our statewide mandate. And the state goals in this area are clear. A water reliability and a Delta ecosystem are the co-equal to goals achieved in a way that recognizes the uniqueness of the Delta. And then there are a host of other things. But that's our focus. That's the focus of state law. And I keep going back to the Kutras rule on state funding. Pete, representing the Delta counties, articulated in one of his presentations to us a couple of months ago the principle that the state should always pay 99 cents of every dollar of spending. And he thought that might be, some of his members thought that might be a little stingy of the state of California. And, you know, the reality is I think that is pretty clearly a part of what the local attitude is, too. It's the endless search for money. There is no pot of easily available money. There's some commonality and interest expressed about regional, the formation of a regional district. Mr. Baldwin's done that. Mr. Machado said that. The DWR draft, previous DWR documents have urged that, and this draft, as I skimmed through it last night, seemed to allude to it. But I can't get past the problem of trying to get a clear policy on state commitment of money without asking the local community why the state should commit vast amounts of money if the local land use decisions are going to expand the number of people at risk in the area being protected. I got it that the state constitution says every kid in California is entitled to a common school education, and the courts in the 160 years have expanded that to, you know, a legal obligation of the state of California to provide for education for everybody from grade one up through high school. I got that. There isn't anything like that in the California Constitution on floods. There's some language you can nudge around. And the statutes aren't as elaborate either. We have these funding plans that have been set up, but the state's very careful for a whole host of reasons, financially mostly, to view the local Delta levy subvention program for non-project levies as discretionary. But we're always inching towards something more than discretionary. And if we started off and somebody came in and said, yeah, the state of California should provide 25% of all levy work of all kinds everywhere in the Delta or the state of California, it might be the wrong call, but it would at least be an understandable call from which policy could flow. But I can't give a crack at it. What's the maximum state amount of money that, not that you want, that's realistic to pay for all this stuff, so we don't get into the constant battle that everything's equally important. All Delta Islands are equally valuable to the water supply system if you're asking for state money on flood controls in exchange. I mean, I don't know how to deal with it, and I can't get past that block. Who wants to solve the problem? Mr. Machado.
I don't think I can solve it. But I think it's part of the dilemma that the commission fails and faces doing an economic sustainability plan in trying to determine what is the value of the Delta and how does that value fit in with the overall state value. But I think one of the challenges that we face is at the local government level in terms of zoning, that is viewed as a revenue source for local government. And so as we restrict that, they come back in and say, okay, how are we going to offset that? Because we end up subsidizing areas that don't produce enough revenue to be able to carry on the services. That argument, on one. Second, not all parties who benefit directly from the protection offered by the levies are participating within the local districts to help fund the ongoing maintenance. So that has to be expanded. A good example in the Jones flooding. There was a move to try to seal off a trestle, which would cut the flooding in half, which would reduce
the railroad trestle.
Right. There was no way to do that. The railroad claimed that they had the jurisdiction. They didn't participate in anything. And in the meantime, the trestle failed. The bank for the railroad failed. The railroad was shut down for several days as they moved
cars.
And
they're still suing the state for the state's negligence.
But they were moving cars in from Colorado to carry the material. You also have a petroleum line that goes through there that wasn't a part of participating within that local RD. East Bay Mud did. So you have to look at all of the sources that are out there that are not a part of the local part. Then I think you have to look at trying to assess the statewide impact of the Delta and then see, and there's people smarter than I am to try to determine an algorithm that would say what should be the assessment
I've got my pen for the Machado rule. Let's say...
Wait.
Yeah, I know you do. Okay, but let's just say that we actually go out and talk about the infrastructure in the Delta and use whatever authority we have to urge, require, or something that they actually be forced to commit to pay a reasonable share of the cost of the flood protection for the infrastructure that's in there. And that's privately owned. It's publicly owned. I understand all the big fights. It's a big fight. that's not a new suggestion. But let's say it's there. What's the state limit on obligation, Mr. Machado, after that? Assume it happens.
Well, let's go back to looking at a geological hazard abatement district, which is a beneficiary's pay, which would involve the state because of their infrastructure.
I bet you we recommend that, too, and we'll try to figure out a way to go beyond mere recommendation somehow. Is there a limit to the state money that should reasonably be spent? And if so, what is it? Because if we don't have that limit, Mike, how can we even talk about the rest of this
stuff? If I had to be consistent, then I was a party to legislation that it looked at it, it'd be no more than 50%.
Great.
As an engineer, I would come at that question from both sides. So the other side to come at it would be, how much money is needed? And where else would it come from if not from the state? Because that might be the other half of your equation. And I would look more broadly than utilities crossing the Delta and rail lines and similar. I'd look also perhaps at people whose water comes across the Delta. And that's a can of worms, but that's where the largest number of people are perhaps drawing the greatest amount of economic benefit. And so it's a revenue source which has not been yet tapped.
Well, but you know, Ray, that is that argument, if you tried to pursue it, is an argument where that increases the notion that you want an isolated facility of any kind to protect water exports, because it means a clear declaration to Delta people, gosh, that means they won't help pay for the protection of the remainder of the Delta, which is still the Delta ecosystem, and the water reliability aspects that remain.
Or you could legislate the other way around. You could say that the plumbing that's created the current Delta has put the current Delta deeply at risk, and so beneficiaries of the water, even with a secure facility, would be paying something into a global pot, which would be more Delta-centric.
And the deep pocket will generate how much money if we do that?
Depends how much money you think you need, and depends what your other sources for revenue might be.
Randy.
Wait. Oh, sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. Then Felicia.
Well, I just add another thought to the mix. I read this FloodSafe framework for Department of Water Resources investments in Delta Integrated Flood Management. It talks about state funding. And in this report, if I read it correctly, it presumes that when the state comes in and helps to fix a levee, that the beneficiaries of that levee repair indemnify the state against...
Well, but that's a standard contract language that is worth... But zip. But, zip.
Okay. Well, but my question is, if the investment of the state monies in levee repairs exempt them from Paterno-type liability, then it's a much better value to fix levees than it is to repair breaches. And perhaps that should be considered as some policy arrangement. But you tell me, yeah, Mr. Attorney, that is not going to happen.
I wanted to address, I have just a little piece of the pie. So money, you said the issue of money. I'd just make two comments. This is peanuts. The problem here is vision, leadership, getting conservative bureaucracies to think about different ways and getting past this damn thing. I keep hearing about how great California is. We've got SIMS, we've got mutual aid. Don't worry about it. Knowing that California could be a hell of a lot better if we get out of the box. And as far as my emergency response fund, when the disaster hits, you're going to spend the money. The question is, are you going to be effective with it, and how effective are you going to be with it? And I think that's what everyone hides it. No one wants to commit to the map because we're going to pretend that we're not going to spend any money because that might be a budgetary impact. But we know when it comes, the governor will go, do it, and we'll start spending money. So the issue is the emergency response fund, I think, starts getting us into a position where we spend it wisely when the response comes and not.
Felicia?
So,
yeah, just a question or a thought. I mean, getting back to the question that you were talking about a moment ago, you know, the reason for looking at an alternative conveyance is multifold. I mean, part of it is the fish in reverse flows and the environmental aspect. The other is the earthquake risk and the risk side. In looking at the costs of alternative conveyance, I'm presumably someone, whether in your EIR and whatever we do in our EIR, is going to have to look at the comparative costs of arming for earthquake versus the conveyance, the earthquake need for the conveyance. I'm not saying this that well. But then you still have the environmental challenges. So it's not a one-for-one, but presumably those costs need to be assessed in order for us or for BDCP to do an effective and adequate alternatives analysis.
And you like good examples that are illustrative, so I'll give you a story. New Orleans and Katrina. The New Orleans levee system that was taken down by Katrina had its inception in 1964 when Betsy flooded about a third of New Orleans. It was built over 5 decades with federal funding that was trickled out slowly by Congress in individual appropriations each year, much like Chinese water torture. And it was never adequate. Every time the Corps requested funding for any sections they wanted to build in the coming years, they would get less than what they'd asked for, and so they were forced to be parsimonious and to take small gambles. But it was also a 50-year design and build window for a levee system that our investigation team judged was going to fail about once every 50 to 70 years. And that was a little bit cold-blooded on the part of our national government, or at least it would have been if they had understood that was the situation. The parsimony and the stretching out of that and the underfunding of each individual element to a small degree probably saved, as best we can estimate, maybe $150 to $200 million with an M. And the best estimates by neutral parties, not the litigants, in the current lawsuit are that losses from Katrina were $150 to $200 billion with a B. So the losses are roughly 1,000 times the savings. And I think in the Delta, we run across the principle with regard to nature and risk that we can pay her now or we can pay her later. And the sooner you get it done, the less it costs you. And preparation is far better than response, but that may be necessary, and response is far better than repair.
Mr. Kane.
So I have a suggestion on how we treat these levees. It's really easy to fall back into this, the Delta levees. Well, the Delta levees, there's different kinds of levees, and I think the more we parse what are the different kinds of levees, we can actually identify who are the beneficiaries of these different kinds of levees, what are the hurdles to getting those beneficiaries to pay, and what kind of hurdles could we get over. So the two basic kind of levees in the Delta are the dry levees and the wet levees. The wet levees that protect lands below sea level, and the dry levees are the ones that mostly don't have water on them, but during floods. So from here upstream on the Sacramento, it's mostly the dry levees. Well, it'd make a lot of sense for SAFCA or the city of Sacramento to invest in expanding the Yolo bypass so that more floodwaters could be conveyed down through the dry levee reaches. And that's the cross-sectional area constricts how much water can be conveyed past Sacramento. But SAFCA, it's hard for them to show a nexus to their in the assessment district that if you pay a certain tax, it's going to have a certain benefit. You kind of got to get the whole state involved to show that what is the nexus between some kind of assessment you'd make on SAFCA to purchase land in Yolo County. And then, so where I'm headed with this is for each type of levy, there are different kinds of beneficiaries, and you can begin to create some mechanisms for those beneficiaries to pay in to the system. On the estuarine levees, for example, why should we be paying for well, there's maybe two kinds of estuarine levees. There's ones that will fail and have a large impact on the water quality, water supply, and there's ones that will have fail and probably have smaller, even a beneficial impact on the water quality and water supply. So it seems to me the ones that would fail and have a very obvious impact on water quality or like the western Delta Islands of Sherman, Jersey, and Brandon Andrus in particular, those are ones where we should demand something from the water agencies, at least in the interim, to keep them, to maintain them. If they fail, a peripheral canal might be great for solving that problem, but it will be harder to force enough water out to meet X2 and the ecosystem relationships and that they may be required to meet under the BDCP. And so then there's another kind of estuarine levy, which maybe if it fails, and I'll use Hotchkiss Tract in the area of Oakley, probably it's going to have no impact on water quality, no impact on floods in Sacramento. So why should the state come in and bail that out? Well, we probably shouldn't.
Can we get the American Rivers list of islands on your designated category, please?
I will work on that.
I mean, you understand, everybody argues this abstract theory that there's some that make sense and others that don't, but there's always this reluctance to finger them because then somebody's left out and the complaints are made. Well, and, you know, the San Joaquin County islands that are left out, everyone says, wait a minute, I'm a citizen too. Treat me the same way.
Good point. You caught me.
Okay.
The last thing I wanted to say about estuarine levies is that if some counties or jurisdictions want to continue to develop below sea level, say, okay, well, we can't stop you from doing that, although I hope you do better than that. I hope you do try to stop them. But if you can't, say, okay, well, fine. If you need to pay, you need to have your developers pay in a certain amount so that all of the Central Delta Islands don't fail. Because if they do fail, then the state's going to have to come to your rescue and build some big flood wall in the future because all of these developments below sea level around the margin are, you know, are going to be washed out by Lake Pontchartrain West.
Pat.
Dave, in San Joaquin County, particularly sort of metro Stockton where I live, there's been a lot of new development in recent years. To what degree does the state contribute to levee stability or maintenance in those?
The urban levees in Stockton get a little tiny bit of subventions money. I believe those are the only ones that they get because if my memory serves, they're not project levees. So the only thing that you're eligible for, that those levies would be eligible for, is subventions. The subventions and special projects are really intended for the ag islands.
Right. And so on the issue of to what degree does the state have a financial obligation, can you make a distinction between those that are urbanized, particularly recently urbanized in North Sacramento or in San Joaquin County, where all of us who decided to buy property there and everybody who developed and built there ought to kind of internalize the cost of the risk that we bought into by moving there or by building there.
I'm not sure I'm
how much does the
exactly.
state pay to protect the urban areas like where
In other words, south of Stockton, Weston Ranch is in the city of Stockton, right? So you read in the paper that it has levee problems now. So, pardon me?
Need your microphone.
Turn the microphone on, please.
That's in part protected by RD-17, which is a project levee.
It's what?
Weston Ranch south is right. protected by RD-17, which is a project levee.
So, does that
You're
mean,
talking about Smith Canal.
We're talking about the recent ones like Weston Ranch. What I'm asking about are there state and federal monies going in to protect levees in risk areas that have been recently built?
The answer is yes, and in RD-17, one of the problems we have here that I don't think has gotten much attention, and maybe it's unique to RD-17, but there's three or four jurisdictions, City of Manteca, City of Lathrop, San Joaquin County, unincorporated, and the City of Stockton, all in Reclamation District 17. So a lot of development got proposed there. Weston Ranch in the late 80s, early 90s, I believe, and then Mossdale Village happened around 2005. And the proposal was for this area to be built out in a larger area, and it was behind 100-year levees, so it wasn't a big problem. Then FEMA came in and said, well, we're not so certain about these levees here, and there was the whole beef about provisional accreditation letter for RD-17. A couple of things happened. So the state has come in and helped bring the levee up to the 100-year standard. And I don't know if you've been out there on the field trip to seeing one of the levee improvements that was done out there. But they took a big winding bend in the river, which would be perfect for a cutoff levee and do a shorter levee. And instead, the state invested helped RD 17 to bolster this big winding bend in the levee. They could have done a shorter stretch of levee, given some river back to the, given some land back to the river, restored the ecosystem, but instead they went in, the state went in and helped invest to protect this piece of land that now someone can come in and develop. The one thing that's happened is the poor people in Mossdale who bought homes for $500,000 are in the, you know, the heart of this foreclosure. There was an assessment on them to upgrade the levees. But unfortunately, you know, when you go to the bond underwriters, there's not enough value there anymore. And Richmond Homes went bankrupt, and they don't have money to build a sewage treatment plant, let alone upgrade the levee. So then they need more help from the state. And if the state doesn't come in and help, then the aspiring middle-class people who bought these $500,000 homes are just in this downward spiral. And I only see more of this happening. So one logic is, well, let's figure out a way to permit all the rest of RD 17 so it all gets built out, and then there's funding to build the levees. Well, I don't know if that's going to really happen. And I don't think you should assume that the whole area is going to be built out, and there's going to be a good enough revenue stream to maintain the levees over time. If developers want to build out there and they think it's a good thing to do, have them post a bond that makes sure that there is enough money in the event that the development doesn't move forward, and that money sits, you know, in an escrow account indefinitely until the whole area gets built out. So in brief, you know, we are basically, the state is subsidizing some of these urban development in urban areas.
And if policy is money, which was Phil's postulate at the beginning of this session, it's more so here than in most. Lathrop has famously got more properties underwater with regard to mortgages than most parts of the nation, but they also run the risk that properties might someday be underwater. And if the second thing happens, the liability will pass to the state through the Paterno ruling. And so the state of California has massive exposure on some of these developments. And unfortunately, as a result of that.
In Stewart Tract, the unbuilt 5,000 acres, the state Board of Reclamation came to some agreement on super levies, which I don't mean to get into the particulars. What I was really looking for, whether in terms of financing, you could make a different kind of judgment about urban areas, new ones or old ones. It gets more complicated because you already have the risk and people there that essentially pay for themselves for going into a inherently flood-prone area, right? So the neighborhood I live in, I think Calaveras River has a problem on the south side, so that's one of the ones that protects my house. But it was built 50 years ago. Still, it's in a flood risk area, and so are all the other neighborhoods. And so are the 10,000 acres, or most of it, that is in the sphere of influence for the city of Stockton, not to mention the thousands of acres that have already been entitled for new development that hasn't occurred. So all of that adds to the flood risk. Should the state have an obligation for assuming part of that risk in the future, or if things, as John indicated, don't turn out so well for a given neighborhood and they don't have any money? Well, if there's a real flood or a real flood risk, the state is going to pay. But what should be our policy in advance to minimize paying for risk as a state cost that is entered into by local property owners, builders, home buyers, all of which is permitted by local government, who could have made a different decision on Western Ranch or on Lathrop, but made the decision to permit the development.
And at no cost or risk to themselves.
That's right.
Mr. Morantz, then Mr. Baldwin.
I believe there's a couple of pieces of legislation that are looking or have looked at addressing that, and have there's requirements for 200-year levees now in urban areas, urbans defined as levee protecting 10,000 people, or an urbanizing area where there will be 10,000 people within the next 10 years. So I think there's an attempt to provide assurances that the levy system is going to give you at least a certain level of protection. I wanted to go back and talk a little bit about the levy systems that we have in the Delta. There's project levies, and the project levies are defined as those levies that are a part of the state plan of flood control. And for those levies, the state, a local agency, and the federal government combined to put in place what they believed to be a 100-year or a levy that would provide flood protection against a 100-year flood. Now, there are residual risk, and sometimes these levees fail before the water surface gets to 100-year. That is when I believe that the state sees that there is some liability. Another system that's in the Delta is the non-project system, and that's where a local agency would have put the levy up for ag purposes, for duck club, for whatever reason they chose to do that. The state did not participate in its construction, and right now the attorneys tell me that we do not believe that we have risk for anything that occurs on that island, even if there are 1,000 people, 2,000 people that live there. I think the courts are probably going to be the ultimate arbiter.
Is 100-year flood protection adequate for a residential neighborhood?
Personally, I don't believe so. I'm not sure that 200-year protection is adequate, but I think the 200-year level is defined as the minimum acceptable for an urban or urbanizing area. A 100-year level is considered acceptable by FEMA. That's where you get your...
Wait a minute.
This is an
Mr.
accident.
Baldwin was next. Okay, right. Then we'll get to you. Then we'll get to Mr. Machado.
Am I up?
Yes, sir.
I think you got to have a little different perspective, at least that I have. You know, in California, you pick your poison. You're going to live in a floodplain. You're going to live on an earthquake fault. You might live on the coast and be subject to tsunamis, right? That'll never happen. Or you're in a wildland area. You know, we cannot offer the public absolute safety. You know, we cannot. I mean, 100-year, 200-year, I mean, we get into engineering discussions, you know. It's like the pioneers. They threw up the levee, and once in a while it broke. You know, the key is that we have to design a system that occasionally, it's just like the Dutch, it does fail, but they pick up the pieces, they move on, and society goes on because, we can't evacuate California. You know, we're going to continue on. What we're not doing is we're getting fixated on parts of that protective system, you know, the levee mostly, you know, and we're arguing 100-year, 200-year, knowing that, 100-year levees sometimes carry higher ones, and, you know, sometimes they break and sometimes they don't, and we flood fight it, but we're not designing, we build that levee to the certification, but we don't design the community so that we can evacuate efficiently, you know, we don't do some things that are really common sense that could be done up front to recognize the fact that someday there will be a subdivision that will flood. It's a tragedy, but it's part of living in California, and we will pick up the pieces and move on, and we're not doing everything we can to ensure that, number one, we limit that to what's acceptable, and at the same time, we prepare for it so that we can, minimize the damage and get things back to normal as quickly as possible. So I only throw that out because, I agree with John and some of his comments is that we just, levees there, well, we fix it and everything. You can put $1 billion there, and we've got, we don't design... You know, we know we're going to have to make a relief cut on RD-17. We know it. You know, when it breaks upstream, we're going to cut it down at the bottom. And if you got a house next to where that cut is, it's going to get swept out because that's going to lower the flood depth. That's going to limit the extent. We're going to do it. Why didn't we put a park there? Should have put a park right next to the relief cut, but we hadn't done this, so no one thought about it.
Okay, a state agency is not normally assumed to locate parks for cities or counties. Now, give money occasionally to pay for it, sure, but they don't normally make that decision, and as best I can determine, no local official wants us to make that decision, unless Mr. Natoli has changed his mind on land use.
Nope.
No. So,
all right.
Look, you have a perspective on this issue that's unique on the panelist.
A lot of people
said
that.
Why do you think Californians, maybe Americans, are so indifferent to prevention and so sympathetic to spending after a disaster has occurred? when you know for a relatively modest amount of money you can avoid a lot of cost and get better results? Why as a culture do we do that?
You get into human psychology and anthropology probably as far as risk denial and et cetera. And the problem with floods as opposed to fires and stuff like that is it's a lot of it's perceived risk. You know, I mean, they just don't perceive the risk because it doesn't happen very often. You know, people wouldn't get on an airplane after 9/11. Probably the safest time to get on an airplane is right after 9/11 because they'd done the attack. You know, the odds that they were going to do a second one the second day. So, I mean, we have a tough time with risk, and if we can push it off, we do. Now, of course, a lot of self-interest comes into pushing it off. I mean, the developer doesn't want to necessarily bring up the issue of risk and others. So if we'd grasp it a little bit better, and we try to tell our people, you know, we can't guarantee you safety. You got to have a little pioneer spirit. Doesn't mean that it's the end of the world. I mean, but you can move. If you don't like San Joaquin County, move to Berkeley. You know, I mean, you can live on an earthquake fault. You know, you can build a subdivision over there or maybe in the wildland area down in Southern California.
Yeah,
and
but,
you can burn
but
up.
Ron, the floodwaters of the San Joaquin River ended up in Stewart Track and saved some other urbanized areas.
Yeah.
Okay. Then that flood receded and the city of Lathrop permitted it for development. And so the developers decided to build really big levees and got those approved by the state reclamation board. So then the question is, if there's another flood, where are those waters going to go? And now we have testimony this morning that we're going to, on Paradise Cut, create a route for floodwaters. Good thing the flood didn't occur before then, right?
Right. You know, I'm not necessarily a supporter of developing in risk areas. I'm just saying that it's a little bit hypocritical to build developments down an earthquake fault and blame somebody for putting it. Now, there's people other than I that decide how that, you know, what's adequate flood protection and when they put that in, how they mitigate.
Well, actually, I raised it in follow-up to the question of who pays. So you want to build there, or I want to buy there, maybe we ought to pay for it. Or do you want to socialize those costs of that new risk over the rest of the people of California or the nation because we decided to build knowing what the risk was?
To the extent that, yeah, the homeowner in there is accepting that risk because they want to own there, I go back to the issue of that you're struggling with is that the Delta also serves other interests, you know. We haven't done a flood contingency map yet because we also put critical infrastructure on here so that we know about it, the pipelines and et cetera. We haven't been able to do one yet where we haven't got some critical infrastructure that serves somebody other than the people actually living in that zone. So that's where it gets more complicated. Now, is it wise to put someone in Stewart Track? You certainly don't want to make the flood issue worse. That's a hydrologist and engineers and the regulatory board's purview. What I say is then also don't be dumb and ignore some of the things you can do to mitigate it so that if we do have a breach, which could happen, and, you know, it is something that we have to recognize that we can minimize the damages and stuff. You know, my question, you know, with Stewart Track is the levees, you know, they did the neat thing. You know, you raise yourself above the flood. My question is, can they pump uphill the sewer when the flood comes and cuts off the power, you know? I mean, because they're going to have to pump uphill to get the sewer out. So how long can the people stay there after, even if they're safe sitting there watching the floodwaters flowing around them? So, you know, these things got to be thought about. And we don't because we fixate on the levee. Once it meets standards, then the board doesn't have any jurisdiction past that levee. And I think there's not enough incentive sometimes to
the board, meaning the reclamation board, or
the big guys. They rename it, but I call it the reclamation board because I'm an old timer and I can't change.
Me too. All right, Ray, then John, then I want to get to Richard on a wrap up because we also need public testimony, and I want to get it in before lunch. So briefly, please.
I want to do some finding of facts for Mr. Johnson in support of his premise because I like it. 100 years is not a good level. Until about the last 20 years, levees for urban regions east of the Rocky Mountains were usually designed for a 250 or 500-year flood level. It's only out west here on the left coast where we use lower standards because we're further from Washington, D.C. FEMA then enacted the 100-year standard, and it wasn't a standard for minimum protection. It was a standard for development and insurance purposes, but it immediately lowered the bar nationally, and so now the national target is usually 100 years, and it was a tremendous mistake. It wasn't their intent to make that mistake, but it was a tremendous mistake. 100 years is not a reasonable level of flood protection. You asked about the Dutch. In an urban region, the Dutch used a 5,000-year level of protection. And then coming back to my neighbor over here, you can choose your poison in California, but if you choose seismic as your poison, use a 500-year level of protection.
Mr. Kane.
I'll try to be very quick. First, on your answer of what's wrong with our culture, Joan Didion wrote a book about it called Where I Was From, and she basically says we were used to just leaving people on the Pioneer Trail and burying them and moving on, and we've been doing it ever since. to really interrupt, she talks about floods and fires. It's a very interesting book.
I would like to know how you'd want us to put that in a regulatory form of the Delta Plan.
I was just trying to be responsive to your question.
I understand.
Who should pay for managing the risk that we're assuming? I have to point out that since I graduated as an undergraduate from the University of California, Berkeley, on the Hayward Fault, it has been under continuous construction, bringing all the buildings up to the highest standards possible. And the people of California and people that pay tuition to go to Berkeley, they got their act together and they're paying for that. And people who want to do additions on the Hayward Fault, they pay for that risk. Ron Baldwin does great work, but he's here begging for money from the state of California to prepare these emergency response maps, which are absolutely a great investment. He's begging for money from the state to protect developments in Lathrop and Weston Ranch and elsewhere. And I think it's time that the people that develop those start paying for Ron's maps right away. And thirdly, is it okay to live on a 100-year, behind a 100-year levee or a 200-year levee? I would gladly live on a floodplain that floods every year to a depth of 12 inches, no problem. And that would be in the FEMA 100-year, inside the 100-year floodplain. But what we really need to pay attention to is not the level of protection, but how deeply does it flood? What would the risk be? And I would not touch a home or purchase a home behind a super levee if that home would flood to a depth of more than 4 feet or 6 feet.
In that floodplain, are you living in a home or on a boat?
I think I would, you know, they have these pillars, these posts, and the boat just floats up with the water, and it would be great. I think I'll go for the boat.
A more elaborate version of Mr. Seed's suggestion for urban neighborhoods with boats. Yes.
In Holland, they have developed boats or homes that are on boats, and they float up as the water comes in and drop back down when the water goes out.
Mm-hmm. Before we get to Richard's thing, I want to say thank you for the panelists. I can't remember how many meetings we've been wrestling with this whole question of threat and all of that, a number of them. And you've helped clarify some issues. Just as you think about this in the days to come, and Mr. Baldwin, you're off to do emergency stuff right now, but any other thoughts you have in writing would be appreciated. We are particularly looking for ways to write our Delta Plan, both in a regulatory and a non-regulatory manner that expresses reality and tries to provide some basic analytical structure to this confusing array of things. And any suggestions beyond the ones you've already submitted that you have, we would very much like to receive. Then the last thing, just keep in mind. Pat and I spend a lot of time doing this, and Don still spends a lot of time doing it. The whole world is interested in a stable and secure source of funding for everything, as am I. I would like to have a stable and secure funding source for everything I would like to. Doesn't exist. The voters have made it far more difficult with the passage of Proposition 26 to consider regulatory fees that might impinge in water areas. You're all dealing with that. We don't know how it's all going to work out. We need some suggestions that can be achieved as well as those suggestions that can be hoped for. And the achievable results are the ones that you could say, damn, we actually have a possibility of seeing them within a relatively short time. I was intrigued in particular with the three of you suggested a regional emergency response flood management area. I think that's a very useful tool. Mr. Grindstaff's been arguing that approach too. But it's only realistic if it has duties and the ability to impose some kind of charge on the benefited parties. Not an easy thing to get through the legislature, but in context of all of this, not impossible either, in my judgment, if it's properly constructed. Doesn't solve all the problems, but, you know, Mr. Baldwin, it may lead the other four Delta counties to move a little faster on their emergency plan. Yours is either adopted or about to be adopted, the Delta specific one. And it might allow some of this planning mechanism to get consolidated because, as you know, each county has their unique perspective and they tend to argue their unique perspective, as Randy and I learned on all these issues on early actions. They support everybody else's actions, but they really like theirs. Help us get through that. Well, I really appreciate it. It was very, very, very helpful. Good of you. Most of you have been here a number of times before, and we will punish you again with another invitation if you if you'll allow us. And thank you very much for that. And Richard, you wanted to talk about a more generic description of things, and I know a couple of you have appointments you have to leave to, so feel free to do that. But we've got to hear from Richard now, and then get public comment.
Mr. Chair, other council members, I'm here to recommend one priority, which is your plan creates or results in accountability for performance of all of your policies. Now, I'll give some examples in the context of risk management, but obviously this priority touches every topic. Now, Chris has already said that you're not a super regulator. That's true. You don't issue the permits for water rights or for land uses or for dredge and fill. And the Delta Reform Act expressly reserves the authorities of the agencies that do issue those permits and adopt plans under the Water Code and the Clean Water Act and the Fish and Game Code and so forth. But that said, the council is plainly more than a bully pulpit. And what I will describe today are some approaches that I believe will contribute to accountability for performance of the policies that you adopt for risk management as well as other resources. Now, the consistency determination is one approach that the statute requires. You're familiar with it, but let me parse it a bit. It applies to covered actions and only covered actions. Now, covered actions include funding decisions by the state and local agencies, and as you said, Mr. Chair, that's very significant. And covered actions also include land use permits. But as I read the statute, covered actions don't include, which is to say consistency determination doesn't apply to, operation and maintenance of the State Water Project, the Central Valley Project, and facilities owned by local agencies. And even more importantly, the consistency determination doesn't apply to regulatory actions by a state agency. Now, that term, regulatory actions by a state agency, is not defined in the Delta Reform Act. And so, in the paper that I prepared and I believe was distributed yesterday morning,
yes,
I went to the Office of Administrative Law on the assumption that general law will help you define that term. And as I understand the term, it includes the permits which state agencies issue, and it includes the plans which they adopt for general applicability. If that's right, then the consistency determination will help with funding decisions, it will help with local permits, but it won't help with respect to regulatory actions of state agencies, including the permits they issue and the plans they adopt. And of course, it won't reach the regulatory actions of federal agencies unless new federal law is enacted that subordinates their supremacy to the council's authority. So that approach is plain on the face of the statute, and yet it's not, because a critical term is not clearly defined. I recommend that you expand Chapter 2 of your draft plan to offer an interpretation of what's subject to the consistency determination and what's not, because plainly all stakeholders are affected by that. So that's one approach. Second approach that's also on obvious on the face of the statute is incorporation of plans prepared by other agencies. There are at least a dozen plans that are called out for you in your discretion to incorporate. And plainly, if you incorporate a plan, then that plan becomes part of the basis for the consistency determination. So there's a consequence, an important consequence to incorporating. But there's also a risk. Think about the water quality control plan for the San Francisco Bay Delta as a for instance. I believe it exceeds 700 pages. You incorporate many plans like that, and you lose any coherency to the Delta plan. And it's not clear to me that incorporating another agency's plan makes it more enforceable. For example, there's an express carve-out for the BDCP. The statute says you will incorporate the BDCP if it meets specified criteria, and then it says that the statute does not create any new claim or cause of action under the Fish and Game Code or any other statute with respect to the BDCP. So while I believe that incorporation of other plans into your plan is a useful approach, it's not clear that it increases the enforceability of what's incorporated, and there's a risk of just overwhelming the policies that you are deliberately adopting here. So let me pause here and describe a design quality for your plan, and I'll relate this specifically to page 8-7, working categories of potential policies and recommendations for risk management. You've got findings, and those are elaborated, and then you have 20 placeholders for policies. In my view, 20 policies is at least 5 times better than 100 policies. Which is to say, your plan, and specifically the policies, should get at root causes and should not try to cover the A to Z. So let me give a for instance, on the occasion of the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic. Have you had the Titanic brought up before in testimony? Well, I'm pleased then to inform you about the root causes for the sinking of the Titanic. Now, we all know that the root cause, that most of the people on the Titanic lost their life because there weren't enough lifeboats. But the root cause for the loss of life was that the ship sank. And why did it sink? It sank because the designer used a form of steel that became brittle in the near Arctic waters that the ship actually sailed into for the first time that night. They didn't think about that. It sank because the bulkheads, which are like levees on a ship, only went part of the way up to the main deck. And as a result, when one of them flooded, the flood water simply went to the next and the next and the next until the ship sank. But here's my favorite. The Titanic sank because of a $25 purchase decision. The lookouts that night did not have binoculars. They could not see the iceberg until it was too late to turn. And so as you think about this plan, focus on root causes and design your policies to get at them and not the 1,001 other details that are covered by other plans. Which leads me to how you deal with all of the things that are not covered by the term covered activities. And let me be specific. You're talking about permits that state and federal agencies will be issuing for activities such as land use or water use. And you're also talking about the agency's own obligations. So permits for regulated uses and the agency's own obligations. I think your plan can include an approach that gets at those, at both categories, which are otherwise exempt from the definition of the of covered activities. And you do it like this. Let's say that your chapter on flow or water in the Delta includes a policy that bears on how the State Water Board issues water quality permits. You frame that policy in a form that is enforceable when the State Water Board itself adopts it. In other words, so far you've been thinking about what happens when we adopt a policy. Turn the table. Adopt a policy which is in effect a request to the State Water Board to incorporate that policy in its own water quality control plan. You can't force it. But once the State Water Board does that, then your policy becomes enforceable as against each permit which the State Water Board then issues. And let me go further. And again, I'm not picking on the State Water Board. I'm just using them as a for instance. Let's assume that there's some particular action that you want the State Water Board to undertake, and you're mindful that the State Water Board, like every other state and federal and local agency, and for that matter, nonprofit corporation, has many plans that aren't necessarily performed, and you want this particular thing to happen. Well, adopt a policy that effectively states such and such will happen by such and such a date. When the State Water Board incorporates that policy into its plan, it could become legally enforceable as a result. So I'm asking you to think not just about how your plan is enforceable within its four corners, but instead how policies that you put into your plan can be enforceable, how accountability will be created for their implementation as cooperating agencies adopt your policies. So let me take a specific example that relates to the topic of this panel. And I'm not an expert in risk management, and this may be oversimplified, but it's the kind of thinking that I believe is useful, at least to start the discussion. There are, what, Mr. Grindstaff, 1,000-plus miles of project and non-project levees in the Delta, correct? Okay. Here's a policy. Every mile of levee will have a plan for operations and maintenance every mile, specifying who's responsible, source of funding, standard for protection. Can you enforce that directly? Well, through funding, yes, but otherwise, no. But what if the Department of Water Resources, which is preparing the Central Valley Flood Management Program, adopted that policy into the plan that they are required to issue in 2012? Even though it's not directly enforceable by you, it becomes enforceable as a condition of that plan. And as a result, it gets implemented. So, in conclusion, I'm asking that you, in your next draft, put a great deal of emphasis on accountability. It's not just the findings, it's not just the performance metrics, it's not just the policies, but how do we know these policies will be implemented? The approach I've described would help, and just to elaborate a little bit further, I think you could also enter into binding agreements, memorandum of agreement with other agencies, both federal and state and local, to achieve the approach I just described. But whatever mechanism might make sense to you as you think further about this. Your plan must create or result in accountability for performance. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to read the memo seriously. I only breezed through it this morning. I'm interested in the ideas. Mr. Grindstaff and Mr. Stevens will chew over them too. And thank you very much for coming and helping. Okay, Ms. Marcus, I'm sorry.
No, I really appreciate the suggestion. I think figuring out how to take the things that end up being just from our power, the issue of a recommendation, I think those recommendations are just as important as the things we can regulate, because the bully pulpit aspect that we have, but I think the way you fine-tuned how we should actually recommend that they be incorporated is great, because the issue is we'll be able to pull out a laundry list of those, and there are ways to hold agencies accountable for those. And oh, sorry, we'll be able to hold agencies accountable in the public eye for either accepting or rejecting or whatever. So we have to have a plan when we roll out our plan for how to get the plan to be implemented where we don't actually have direct power. And you've suggested a very, I think, well-crafted way to frame that.
And Ms. Marcus, if I may, I'm suggesting that you not frame anything as a recommendation. Frame everything as a policy, and then work out an understanding with each agency to whom that policy is directed, where that agency commits to implement the policy.
And if the agency disagrees, do we delete the policy?
Okay. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Richard, thank you very much. Okay. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we have some folks who want to talk to us. We're going to try to wrap this up by 12:15, if we can. Mr. Eric Ringelberg, Reclamation District 3, 150, 554, 551, 999. If you hit the base of the microphone to turn it on, you'll... Okay, well, let's... Sure.
Good morning, and thank
morning.
You for taking the opportunity
sure.
to speak with the local North Delta districts and our coalition. Our coalition was formed in order to be able to streamline conversations between your organization and various processes, including BDCP. I wanted Richard actually made a couple, I think, very important conclusions that we also support, which is one, there's some significant problems with process. I think everyone in this room understands those problems with those processes. Breaking down the stovepipes, I think, would be the most important thing that this group could do. The lack of communication is institutional. The only way to break down that lack of communication is to re-envision that institutional process. Let me get back to this. So the districts are really the front line for both the flood fight, the risk that we've heard about here, as well as we're ground zero for all the projects that have been proposed for this area. You're sitting within Reclamation District 999, surrounded by our levees. You're sitting on mineral soil, well above sea level. Well above in district sense, and we're about 8 feet above sea level. You're in the legacy Delta legacy town of Clarksburg. The district provides the town and agriculture protection from flooding in the winter, and we provide water in the summertime for agricultural use. I think yesterday's comments, I'll talk a little bit about yesterday and then come back to today in terms of risks. Jonas Minton and Leo made some excellent comments, and I'd like to just quote right from Leo's comment, which is, inclusion of local government and Delta residents is essential if we wish to accomplish the first two priorities, restoration and new conveyance. And I think most people consider that self-evident. Unfortunately, the processes to date, Delta communities and particularly the reclamation districts have not been either invited to the process or involved at all in the planning and decision-making. Not quite so true for the Delta Protection Commission, but certainly in a process and processes that directly affect us, not just directly in terms of our operations, but also financially. Let's go on here. So And frankly, we face the consequences of people making planning decisions in Sacramento or San Francisco or the South San Joaquin Valley over this area as if it was some sort of, in some cases, a park or in some sort of theoretical drawing where you can just draw a circle around something and say this can happen here and this can't happen here. And there are people who live here. There's multi-million dollar industries that are out here. Walk out the front door, you can see our highly efficient irrigated systems on drip. This region has had a lot of carefully considered planning already in place. And any plans that supersede that need to recognize and work with the districts so that we can come up with a positive solution that works for everyone. And I think that's really the theme that the district coalition wants to bring to this. We have this district, 999, as you came into town here, you could see our smelt-ready fish screens up on the bank. One of the first districts out here collaboratively worked with nonprofits to get a smelt-ready fish screen in place so that the water that we take in actually meets regulatory requirements. On the other hand, despite that state-of-the-art facility on the Sacramento River, our flood-fighting equipment is a turn-of-the-century cast-iron leather belt pump system that was diverted here from Holland at World War I. And so this is the mix of complexities that really is the foundation for what happens in the Delta. Some things are incredibly sophisticated and modern, and other things are legacy issues that we're stuck with for financial or for lack of vision in terms of planning. So with respect to today's panel, we do support the prioritization and streamlining of funding of levee repairs and, frankly, desperately needed better emergency response system. I think you heard a lot about the very small investment that's needed to have a coherent planning process. DWR has started and attempted to do a lot of stockpiling, create some planning processes, but I think you heard from the expert here today, we're not nearly ready enough. And it's something very simple. Stockpiling of equipment, heavy equipment, fuel, frankly, simple things like fuel cells for levee pumping systems. If we have a bad enough electrical failure out here, we're on standby diesel generators and they're not very reliable. There are state-of-the-art technology that we can do that has almost no impact that we can pre-establish throughout the Delta. Let's see. So I won't continue. There's been a lot of discussions, theoretical discussion, frankly, from our perspective about risk. I've heard very clearly from the chair, we agree and we need to plan and implement, not just talk about, all these issues. I think everyone here has been through at least one of these processes for the last 20 years. There's a reason why those processes didn't succeed. I think it's incumbent on us to learn from those processes and work to make this one succeed. If there's one lesson we can take away from CalFed is we know really well what doesn't work. Let's try to work on things that may be low-hanging fruit, but at least they're an opportunity to work collaboratively. Let's see. So I mentioned earlier that council can help the existing processes by breaking down the stovepipes. We need to reintegrate the planning processes, and we'll use this area as one perfect example. We have Sacramento across the river. We're within Yolo County. Solano County is just to the south of us. The only integration that really happens is the folks on the ground who spend the time to talk to each of those different organizations, each of those agencies, talk to each of the regulators. We have a complex, as everyone knows, complex state and federal regulations that overlap, sometimes enforced, sometimes not enforced. Very difficult for us to execute our work on the ground when our permitting cost, I think you've heard this earlier, is somewhere between 30 and 50% of our project costs. Don't necessarily advocate for a change of that process, but maybe a regional general permit style process, something where at least multiple agencies work together for one common planning purpose within the Delta. Let me wrap this up. Yesterday, Jason was asking for certainty in an uncertain world. We'd like that too, but I honestly don't think that we can realistically expect any of that. What we are prepared to do as the District Coalition is to work closely with the Stewardship Council to work to start solving some of these problems right now and to try to get some of these things actually implemented on the ground. We may not get it right the first time, but at least we can start learning from some of these things now. Thank you.
Good.
Thank you very much. Ms. Connie Ford, Sacramento County Water Resources. Ms. Ford. Ms. Ford was reading Plato yesterday at our meeting, brought a very significant book with her.
Is that review. What it was?
Yes.
Is that what it was?
It was.
Connie Ford, Sacramento County Water Resources. I just wanted to take the opportunity to let you know that I had the opportunity to work actively on flood fighting. Okay, it was a few years ago, probably 15 or so, and I was younger and stronger then. However, and I was working in San Joaquin County in a city there, and every, I can't remember if it was late summer, early fall, everybody in the city had training on what our roles and responsibilities were in the event that a flood was or a high water event came. And so we had drills. We learned how to pack sandbags. We learned how to walk the levees and determine what was a problem and what wasn't. We knew who we were supposed to call. We knew all of this stuff. My first year there, flood. Had the opportunity to be out in it. I could pack a sandbag. I could be in my position on the crew handing it off. We knew when it was out of what our level could do and the calls were made in. We knew who was supposed to make the calls for the Conservation Corps, the other contract labor that would come in. And it was really good. We had the follow-up meetings afterwards. We knew which charge codes we charged to, and I don't know. I wasn't the bean counter. So I don't know who got credit for doing what. I knew which duties got charged to which codes, and the training and the follow-up and the work all had different codes. So you could ask somebody there what that was. We knew when we were on alert to help with the private levees, because our first current concern was our levee, and we crossed over private levees to observe our levees. And so there were agreements, I assume, for some remuneration if we were called to assist with those levies. But we knew when we were on alert to watch for what other levies. And it was a very nice, we knew where we stand. It was, or stood. It was planned. We were prepared. And that's a snapshot. I don't know if they still do it. I assume from Mr. Baldwin's comments and meetings that I've been in, that he's been in, that they still do that. And I don't remember if he was there, but I know OES, FEMA, those were all acronyms that were tossed out. But it was a very good system that was in place then. I hope it's still in place. It appears to me he has his in place. It just occurs to me that to put a policy in place that requires that this be done would be very good. Now, I've worked at a handful of public local agencies, and all of them didn't have that. And some of them were, you know, my first question is, do we have a disaster plan? What's my role? And some of them are more the deer in the headlights. A what? Are you kidding me? So my point is that everybody does not have that, and it doesn't occur to them that they don't have it. So it's a good policy to put in place that it be there. Now, they'll participate or they won't, but if they have credit for that, if there is an event, they might miss the first one, but boy, they'll be ready the second one. So that would be my suggestion. And I think that it's inexpensive dollars. I think if there's an advantage to provide some carrots for them to implement that at the time, I think it will provide more incentive for them to do that. If they can build up the relationship where there is more coverage and intercommunication between agencies so that the railroads are included, so that the, you know, all of the infrastructure is covered instead of everyone just looking at their little piece with their blinders on, I think it would be advantageous. I know you start somewhere and you build from there. There's no other way to do it. However, my experience in working under that training was invaluable. I'm old, I'm decrepit now, but you know, this little old grandma, if the creeks in my neighborhood were flooding, I'd be out there packing sandbags. And I know I can do it, because if you put more sand in a sandbag than the grandma can carry, you're doing it wrong.
Okay, Mr. Fiorini, a question.
Connie, I just wanted to respond. I think you're referring to the 97 flood event.
97, 98. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there was in a number of counties a lot of multi-agency responses that plans that went into effect very effectively at that time. And there is a report that we have been provided that was a summary of those actions with recommendations for mm-hmm. improvements that could be made at the multi-agency level. So you're very correct that there were some good things that happened. A lot of training and planning went into preparation for an event like that, and in most cases the emergency response was carried out very effectively. So we are probably going to take into account some of the recommendations that came out of that report that have not yet been done that probably should be done. So thanks for reminding us of that.
And that was the other valuable part of that, is whether or not there was an event. We always had the follow-up in the spring that was everybody doing what they were supposed to be doing? Was everyone available if the call came? And so that was whether or not there was an event. And then the lessons learned and the on what levees and what spot, trouble spots there were when there were repairs done, what did they find? So we did a lot of follow-up, whether or not there was issues and depending on the level of it. So it was a very excellent experience for Young in my career.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Rents from Aqua.
Morning, council members. Mark Rents, Association of California Water Agencies. I will try and be brief because I'm sure people are hungry and perhaps a little cool and could use some sunshine.
We're using this technique all the way through this year. It keeps people awake.
Keeps people brief and keeps them on their toes.
Right.
I'm going to cover two areas if I could. First of all, I'd like to respond to the panel that came in this morning and offer up a policy suggestion, though the wording is probably not very well as I was scratching it on my pad of paper. And it kind of ties into the previous speaker. And then I'd also like to respond to Mr. Bruce Collins' comments if I could. Policy suggestion is something along the line of interagency coordination at all levels of government needs to be improved in terms of incident command for emergency response and emergency response preparation. Ties back to the concern that Mr. Baldwin suggested several times during his discussion, and I believe Ms. Marcus was empathetic with that concern in one of her responses. It was kind of deja vu for me because when we took on this issue very early on in just an oversight in an overview discussions, I made a suggestion. I want to reiterate that suggestion, and that suggestion was that perhaps staff wanted to coordinate or inquire of California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection and the U.S. Forest Service. This was the same problem that when I was with the Forest Service in the early 80s, they had problems with interagency coordination and jurisdiction. And it went right down to some of the issues that Mr. Johnson raised in terms of funding questions. I can remember fighting on wildfires where equipment desperately needed to fight the fire stayed on the low boy because there's jurisdictional questions and liability questions while the fire raged. The result of that, those catastrophic mismanagement, as I will call it, was the Interagency Fire Cooperation Memorandum of Agreement. I suggest you look at it. It may have some give you some hints on how federal, state agencies came together. And ultimately, that led to some discussions, Mr. Johnson, with regards to your concern, as CDF has had over the years, with how do we deal with wildfire management and planning with the urban interface, urban sprawl into the urban wildland interface. So they started discussing who has financial responsibilities, how do we design programs, much like you're raising the question about how do we deal with development in flood risk areas. So I just wanted to throw that out there as a possibility of a resource. Some people have done it. Cut to Mr. Collins' comments. Generally speaking, I concur completely with the three general conclusions that Mr. Collins raised. And I just want to read three points from the comments we submitted on February 28th, 2011, in response to the first draft. And they all come from one paragraph. Mr. Collins raised the question about the consistency determination and and covered actions. In that paragraph, we said the plan should clearly delineate what actions constitute a covered action consistent with Water Code Sections 85057.5 and 85.225, so agencies know in the future what they are expected to when they are expected to comply with the consistency determinations issue Mr. Collins raised. Second issue Mr. Collins raised was how do we deal with making sure that you get to the root causes, not A to Z, when he referred to all the findings. We expressed that concern also. We were concerned that the council may overreach and assume far too much responsibility for itself under the plan, and we've got more detail in there that I would see as being somewhat consistent with Mr. Collins' conclusion. His third conclusion was he talked about how do you deal with what is within your authorities and what's not, and we alluded to that too, and we said the Delta plan must be absolutely clear about the actions will be taken under the council's authority and which actions will be taken under the authority of other state and local agencies. In a general sense, what I'm trying to say here is there may be some common threads between what Mr. Bruce Collins said and what are some of our concerns and suggestions are to you that we can build off of. I'm not familiar with other people's comments. I haven't had the chance to read them all, as I'm sure not everybody has. But I do think finding those common threads that you can weave into your plan is where you start building a foundation for success that you can grow upon. So I just wanted to leave you that thought, and thank you for your time, and hopefully you get out to the sunshine soon.
Thank you very much, sir. Next speaker is Mr. Doug Wallace from EBMUD. Mr. Wallace.
Good morning. Doug Wallace with East Bay Municipal Utility District. Mr. Chairman and members of the council, I was recalling comments from your attorney, Chris Stevens, about what the council can do in relation to strategic or the importance of identifying strategic levy investments and priorities. And I think that's really going to be a core part of the solution here. I certainly appreciate the difficulties of establishing a sustainable funding source, but undertaking this exercise of identifying those assets and activities will at least provide the basis for establishing a funding mechanism when the conditions are right, and I don't know when that will be. Several years ago, East Bay MUD supported SB 34, I think it was Senator Torlakson's, which in one of its versions would have established a benefits assessment district, and in that way bring out all the beneficiaries in establishing such a funding mechanism. So that's something that we are on record as supporting. Some of the council members, maybe not all, know that East Bay MUD commits $1.5 million a year to levy improvements and maintenance. So this is something that we're walking the talk and hope that by bringing in all the beneficiaries, we can actually have a sustainable protection system for the Delta levies. Another comment was about how the export water contractors benefit from the levies but aren't paying, and if there were a new conveyance in the future, would there be a disincentive for them to continue supporting payments to the levies? I just point out that new conveyance, as we all know, is many years away, so there's an interim period here that really counts when payments should be made, the levies must be maintained, and our attention should be on that this interim period as well as the long term. I think that covers my remarks. Thank you very much.
Sir, thank you very much. Melinda Terry, Ms. Terry, Central Valley Flood Control Association. You certainly can.
Well, I think we can all agree after today's panel, we all understand we can't eliminate the risk of flood, but, you know, our goal obviously is to always try and reduce the risk of flood. And what I heard today and really want to reinforce in my comments is that the cost of reducing the risk of flood is a lot less expensive than the cost of repairing and recovery from the flood. So I think we really need to keep that in mind. And so that goes for the improvements in the levees, if you will, to, again, reduce the risk so that we hopefully can at least avoid the higher costs of repair and recovery. And the same can go for the emergency preparedness. Again, being prepared certainly is going to reduce your costs, hopefully, of avoiding the failure. The recommendation for the funding for the emergency response account is a good idea because, it will reduce the overall cost. If they've got a fund that they know they can immediately go to and they can respond in less than 48 hours, my understanding, again, is those costs, the damage that's avoided, if you will, in that waiting, longer 72 hours, is a lot less money. So it's just something to think about. I, completely agree the politics of figuring out where the money comes from is the big bugaboo. But at least let's think about if it were there and they could respond quicker, that our costs are less, and so don't we all benefit in the long run? But again, I agree it's complicated on the other end of that. I think I covered that. And I think Richard kind of hit on that too, which is the root causes of the failure. Again, it's the levies and keeping our eye on that. So I agreed with him on that. However, one of the things that he brought up was the idea of requiring plans for every mile. And I know that sounds really good, but keep in mind that if you're going to require something like that, then you're asking potentially reclamation districts to spend their maintenance funds on a plan instead of spending it on maintaining and improving that levee. And as I started off with, that's your biggest bang for the buck. So let's be careful of requiring them to do too much upfront planning using their maintenance dollars, because in the end, we all are going to pay for the failures that will occur because they were spending on that their maintenance money to maintain and improve those levees. Again, reduces the risk of flood that I was speaking of. The same can be said for the emergency response. Again, I want to caution us. I like the thought of being prepared. I'm familiar with Ron Baldwin's plans that they prepared. It's very impressive. But we also need to make sure that we're investing the money in some of the equipment, whether it's rock or it's, I know, and I'm happy to say DWR has used in the past year, maybe 2 years, to invest in buying some of these temporary barriers that can be put up really fast. So just keep that in mind, that it's a balancing act, that you're balancing your recommendations, making sure that there's money to actually improve and maintain these levees or actually buy equipment for flood response, and that it's in different areas so that can be accessed really quickly. Because I'll tell you, we've kind of, and a lot of people, Richard might even mention it, the Central Valley Flood Protection Plan and hanging your hat on it, just be careful, because one of our complaints, and we're really fearful about as an association, is we're spending a lot of money on process, and we're not leaving a lot of money at the back end for the actual projects. So that would be my request, as you're really prioritizing your plan, make sure that you're balancing not just planning for something, but you're prioritizing recommendations to actually invest in the improvements and the equipment that can reduce everyone's costs in the end. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Terry. Ladies, do we have any more? Nope. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, those are all the slips we had on speaking. Questions by members. Mr. Grindstaff, 18th will be the second staff draft. We'll reflect some of what we've learned this week, and we'll have to do some research on other aspects, of course.
We will, but these 2 days have given us lots of things to think about.
Okay, and I'll remind you again, you're going to send out a refresher memo to us on the potential meetings going all the way through the adoption of the plan, just so council members can confirm the definite meeting schedule and then at least flag the additional days if we get stuck with additional days in whenever it was, August, September, October.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Any further questions, business? Okay. Meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much.